At that time when I think Callaghan brought in his first Race Relations Act in the 60s, you know, a little bit ahead of when we were doing this, they had to leave the police out of it because the police were not prepared to be told how they should behave in terms of race relations. And I went to, as we all did, you know, some of the do's, and there was this sort of, I thought, rather unhealthy alliance between the bar and you know, barristers who worked at the criminal bar, and judges and senior police officers. You know, it was kind of like a, well, I think to no small extent it was Masonic, but I mean, there was certainly a sort of Freemasonry in terms of the way they reacted and related to each other.
There are these 2 6-foot geezers with size 12 boots on. You know who we are, then.
And we did hint at that, didn't we, in this from time to time?
Yeah.
I think we pushed it as far as we could. I suppose we all, at that time, and still, you know, one resents the kind of self-censorship that the establishment imposes on television, creative television people, isn't it? I mean, you know, you end up sort of censoring yourself because that's the only way you can get it through.
Yeah.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 30th of September, 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, and on the BCFM Politics Show app, or even the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which you can tell all your people who you know with iPhones that it's now also on the App Store there. Available free from most good app stores and not necessarily Google. And I found this actually quite useful because everybody is kind of cajoled into using Google Play on their Android phones and cajoled into logging in every time you want to download something. But you don't need to do any of that. If you go to the link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to download the app, we bypass the Google App Store and you can go and get it from a free app store. Which is not necessarily Google. In fact, it's not Google at all. So, I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade, zero-carbon and Ukraine psychological warfare propaganda, as well as promoting medical misinformation, doing a little bit less of that, in fact. In fact, there's some sort of strange contrition going on in the mainstream press at the moment, where they're going, oh, gosh, did we get it all wrong? Well, we've been saying that since February 2020 here on this show, which is why we got booted off of FM by a man called Patrick Hart, who's the station manager at Bristol Community FM, or as Ron earlier said, what was it, BSFM? I think you called it accidentally, serendipitously. So this week's guests are retired international relations lecturer Ron Mandel, and will be joined a bit later by another ACORN member, that's Ruth Nestor. So navigating us through the Fourth Reich Matrix, or the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, whatever you want to call it, and hopefully not into a Third World War. Hopefully negotiating us around that is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Part one this week, we're slightly topsy-turvy because Ron's got to go at six, so we'll be looking at some of the international stories first. So first of all, obviously, the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline this week. And then we've got the economist Steve Keane, Australian economist, who's actually in Bangkok at the moment. He'll be giving us his take on the incredible mini-budget, which seems to have caused so much mass turbulence. And hard-nosed Kamikwazi Kwarteng and Liz Truss are refusing to do and say anything about it, except for, oh, it's OK, don't worry, by the end of November, the Office of Budget Responsibility will publish the forecasts. Well, actually, we want them now. In fact, we know those forecasts are that you've made a complete hash of this and you need to just get out of the way and let someone that knows what they're doing take over. Also, the mass trespass. I went along to down near Crawley in Surrey, Sussex. I'm not sure, actually. It's actually Sussex, isn't it, Crawley? Last Saturday. We'll be hearing a bit of recording from down there. The slow death of the National Health Service. Ron has got something for us on that. And also the Mayor Marvin Rees here in Bristol turns up at the scene of a council house fire where someone died due to a catching fire of a charging bicycle, electric bike, and gets booed off the premises and water thrown over him, or at least some woman tried to throw water over him because they were saying the council doesn't care about council tenants. In part two, we look at the Queen's death certificate with Dr. David Halpin. Three things wrong on that death certificate, you'd be amazed to know. So they published that yesterday. I mean, we've been questioning the why we weren't told the Queen's cause of death. And so in part two, we'll be looking at why there's three serious problems with the Queen's death certificate. And we've got documentaries, looking at a couple of documentaries this week. One most important is this one called Safe and Effective that Oracle Films have put out this week. And so that's with Seema Malhotra, and he has also got a documentary about vaccine injury. Finally, a look at creation science, which is a fascinating topic. This is to do with entropy. So that's the show for this week. And let's start by introducing Ron Mandel. Ron, you were on when we were on FM, weren't you? A few, gosh, must be a couple of years ago. Just give us a little bit of a take on your background, because you used to teach international relations, didn't you?
Yes, I'm an academic who had to reinvent himself. My PhD is in U.S. labor history. When I started lecturing, it was in American studies. Then I moved to history when American studies program was closed. And then I was redeployed to teach international relations and politics at the University of Northampton, and I moved to Bristol in August 2018.
So Ron, what do you make of the incident this week, which has got to be the top of the program, which is this apparent sabotage of Nord Stream pipelines, two of them? I mean, this is a deadly serious thing going on here. These are the lifeline. We've got protests going on in Germany with pensioners and many other Germans saying we don't want to have to pay double and treble for our gas supplies. Thanks very much. We want to have some Russian gas here. These, a lot of these people, elderly people, are people who can remember the Second World War and the horrors of the Eastern Front.
Well, my take on what's happened last week is just another escalation of the war in Ukraine. And all this is happening very quickly. There was the talk about a nuclear threat posed to Ukraine by the Russian government. Then you had the referenda, which was just held in the four regions, which constitute, I think, 15% of the Ukraine territory. And now you have what seems to be an act of sabotage. And that seems to be the consensus among the EU and NATO spokespersons. The subtext seems to suggest that Russia is behind that, but it doesn't make any sense why Russia would sabotage its own pipeline.
Well, this is what the BBC have told us. I mean, I must admit, I was just thinking rubbish as soon as I saw that. Martin, what do you make of it?
Well, I think the idea that the Russians would sabotage their own pipeline, it would then be spun in the Western media as a false flag by the Russians to make it look as if it was NATO in order to try and muddy the waters. But I think it's such a convoluted line of argument that it's obviously
rubbish.
So
the idea is that the Russians blew it up in order to try and blame NATO for it?
Yeah.
I mean, is that really going to work?
Well, no, I mean, it's interesting that because, you know, in the past, when people like ourselves talked about false flag terrorism, we were accused of being, you know, conspiracy nutcases, tinfoil hat brigade or whatever. But now with this, in the last few years, there's been an attempt to suggest that the Russians, the evil Russians, behave in, create false flag terrorist incidents, and that, you know, our intelligence services are wise to this sort of thing and so on. But of course, what's really happening is the degradation of diplomacy and the sensible discussions. We used to have sensible, level-headed discussions when the Soviet Union was run by the Communist Party. We signed all sorts of deals with them about nuclear weapons, which were in everybody's interest, and everybody agreed that it was in everybody's interest. But modern democratic Russia is apparently the devil incarnate, and we can't talk to them at all.
The pipelines, what is this economic significance? Because the fact that the Russian gas has not been coming seems to be mainly due to sanctions by the West. And yet now it's almost like a fait accompli now. So even if Western governments and the Germans, etc., decided to vote due to domestic political pressure to have some of this gas, as these protests might have, they may have got somewhere with their protest movement. Now there's no chance of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the obvious thing to say, isn't it? That there's a possibility that as the crisis in Germany in particular gets worse over the winter, that there would have been strong pressure for them to come to some accommodation about this. Not least because they spent a load of money building this Nord Stream 2 pipeline. It's there ready to go. And it's ready to be switched on, you know.
One of the most incredible things about this, Ron, is that we're told, it looks the Russians probably did it, but we're not given any explanation as to why.
Well, because there is no explanation why they would do it, because it would not be in their interest to sabotage a pipeline which basically links them with Europe and basically reaffirms the economic relations between Western Europe and Russia. It seems to me that what we're missing here is the political economy of the energy supply to Europe. Most of the European countries are not sufficient in oil and natural gas. The United States is probably the only country that is. And it's probably in the interest of the United States to see an embargo against Russian natural gas, because of that strengthens the U.S. oil and natural gas interests.
It certainly does quite nice for the Americans. And also, of course, as the price of energy goes up, so all this nuclear energy suddenly starts to become a bit more viable.
Yeah.
And many of these energy companies are getting better profit margins, whereas they were being a bit squeezed beforehand, maybe. I mean, the most obvious thing to do right now is to play this clip with Joe Biden from February, where he talks about what might happen to Nord Stream 2 if the Russians... This is just before the Russian invasion, just in the first week of February, Biden... This is what Biden had to say. So let's have a listen to that now.
Let me answer the first question first. If Germany... If Russia invades, that means tanks or troops crossing the border of Ukraine again, then... There will be no longer a Nord Stream 2. We will bring an end to it.
How will you do that exactly, since the project and control of the project is within Germany's control?
We will, I promise you, we'll be able to do it.
So that's, we will bring an end to it, he says. And they have, haven't they?
Well, that's if you believe the United States actually has agents working either through the CIA or through NATO or even through Ukraine, a government actually is behind the sabotage. We don't know. We don't have enough information even to conjecture what was.
Well, it's from a cui bono point of view, Martin. It does look like the Yanks have got the most to gain from this, particularly having threatened to do it 6 months ago. NATO, and there's a fantastic article about all this in the UNS Review, which is by Pepe Escobar. Germany and the EU have been handed over a declaration of war. It says it's saying they basically this is an act of war on Russia. Russia knows who's done it, and they're being quite restrained in not blowing up American pipelines at the same time. He's saying NATO, for its own part, has been very active on the underwater drones department. The Americans have access to long-distance Norwegian underwater drones, which can be modified to other designs. Alternatively, professional Navy clearance divers could have been employed on the sabotage, even as tidal currents around Bornholm are quite a serious matter. So it gives them... What this means is, when you've got a lot of tidal currents, it means you've got a bit of a window of maybe 2 or 3 hours, because the tides are moving so fast, the divers got to get in there, plant the explosives and get out pretty quick.
Well, I mean, Rich Sikorski, who used to be the Polish foreign minister in the Civic Platform government, he tweeted, "Thank you, United States, for doing this." You know, he was approving of the sabotage, and he was saying thanking the United States for doing it. And he's quite a senior figure. The Poles have got a very anti-Russian policy. I mean, I used to live in Poland. I know what their attitudes are. So they must be suspects, because they're not far away, and it could be that they've acted because they've been very hostile to Nord Stream 2, because up to now pipelines to Germany have run through Poland, and they've been able to switch it off as a way of putting pressure on the Germans and the Russians to do what they want. So they've been very hostile. I mean, the whole creation of Nord Stream 2 was done in order to avoid having to send gas through Ukraine or Poland to Germany. And, of course, the Americans have never been happy about that. They weren't happy about the original creation of pipelines in the 70s and 80s, but that was to do with the Ostpolitik of Willy Brandt and the Germans. They developed economic relations with the Soviet Union as a way of trying to, you know, make war unthinkable. And of course, that's all been rolled back.
Another thing Pepe Escobar says is the Danish Minister of Defence met urgently with NATO Secretary General on Wednesday this week. I think wasn't it Monday or Tuesday, you remember? After all the explosions happened very close to Denmark's exclusive economic zone, it's just outside their zone, so in international waters, that may be qualified as crude kabuki at best, he says. Exactly on the same day, the European Commission, NATO's de facto political office, advanced its trademark obsession, more sanctions against Russia, including the certified to fail cap on oil prices. Meanwhile, the EU energy giants are going to lose big time with this sabotage.
Yeah, it's a major event. I think what the Russians have said is what Ron was saying a minute ago. We shouldn't jump to conclusions. There's going to be an investigation. It should be a criminal investigation. And if that leads back to NATO intelligence services, I think people in Germany in particular are going to be very, very cross. Rightly so.
There's also the question of other pipelines that might be hit. In Turkey, there are pipelines, etc., to backups and forwards to Russia. So there's questions about where's this going to end? I mean, in a way, it's kind of similar to the attacks on the oil tankers, Ron, do you think? Maybe? I mean, the idea is energy supplies going from Russia to the West are now under threat, and it's almost all no holds barred. So we're just going to stop this energy moving around, even if countries don't agree with the US policy on it.
Well, I think it is a dangerous escalation, going back to my point earlier. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the sabotage, what appears to be a sabotage of the pipelines, took place at the same time that the referenda within the four regions within eastern Ukraine, which constitutes 15% of Ukrainian territory, were being held. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think they're closely tied, and I think it's giving more ammunition, quote-unquote, no pun intended, to NATO and the EU to increase sanctions against Russia. And they have now announced they're going to cut imports from Russia. They're not going to import certain goods into the EU market. So I do agree with Martin. I think a criminal investigation would be required, but I'm not quite sure that's going to be politically possible, given the possible interest that might be threatened by an investigation.
I mean, who's going to go down there and have a look and see what's blown up what kind of remains of explosives there are down there?
Well, interestingly enough, there were three bombs, and two of them were on the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, and they're all quite separate, you know, they're kilometres apart, and one was on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, but there's still one pipeline, Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which hasn't been blown up, and it may be that there's down there is an unexploded charge on the fourth pipeline.
Maybe I call it a kind of booby trap down there. This is all a bit James Bond, isn't it?
It is, and if people were more aware, they would realise how close we are to the edge. It's probably as close as we've been since 1962, but we've got so used to being on the edge that people do not realise how potentially dangerous all this is.
Ron, if he is a US provocation, we're not sure. We're thinking the evidence suggests it might be. If it is, this is deadly serious, isn't it? Because you've got a situation of potential war breaking out in Europe, sparked by the United States, 3,000-4,000 miles away. You know, we in Europe don't want a war.
Well, that assumes that Putin, the Russian government, will rise to the bait, and I don't think they will. I think the Putin government has gotten a bloody nose in the war in Ukraine. Politically, there's unrest within Russia, even within the military high command. There seems to be some questioning of Putin's judgment. There seems to be growing evidence of resistance to conscription within Russia. I think Putin would probably be a bit more cautious. I don't think he would rise to the bait. Martin referred to 1962. Well, in 1962, fortunately, cooler heads prevailed because Khrushchev, you know, he basically said, well, you know, we're going to pull the missiles out of Cuba as long as we could strike a deal with the United States over the missiles in Turkey. And they struck a deal. But, you know, the difference was that Kennedy and Khrushchev talked to each other. You know, no one's, you know, is Biden talking to Putin? Is anyone from NATO or the EU speaking to Putin?
Well, the answer is no, obviously. And that's, and if you compare the two situations, there was, you know, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, there wasn't really a proper hotline. And the Cuban Missile Crisis led to the creation of a hotline. And at some times there have been discussions between Gerasimov, who's the head of the Russian armed forces, and Miley, who's the head of the US armed forces. But, you know, people shouldn't be worried about that. That's what should be happening. These people should be talking to each other, and if they're not, there's a problem.
Well, we're going to need to keep a little eye on these pipelines, aren't we, in future, underwater or over the ground. It gets worse, says Pepe Escobar. And I'll put a link up to this article. Germany and the EU have been handed over a declaration of war by him on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. It gets worse, he says. There are no holds barred anymore on the pipeline terror front. Russia will be on red alert on the Turk stream, but also something called the Power of Siberia pipeline. Same for the Chinese and their maze of pipelines arriving in Xinjiang. I mean, the Russians are massive exporters of gas, and particularly, it's a particularly vulnerable thing, a pipeline, isn't it?
It is, and I think one of the things I've been reading this week is that the insurance for covering pipelines is going to be affected by this. So, you know, there's going to be private sector, that people are going to say, well, if you're going to build a pipeline, you're going to have to insure it, and it's going to cost you a lot of money.
That ain't going to help.
Because they are vulnerable.
That ain't going to help the price of gas.
No, it isn't.
So, anyway, Ron touched on it there briefly. Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin, has approved the annexation, they say. Some say the annexation, or some would say just simply the joining of these Ukrainian provinces to the Russian Federation ceremony today. Russian President Vladimir Putin took the first step to get these four Ukrainian territories into Russia by signing documents at a ceremony this morning. After the signing, the European Union immediately released a statement claiming this annexation, in inverted commas, was illegal. What they're saying, Martin, is that because this has taken place in a war zone, this referendum is null and void.
Well, I don't think this what's happened was originally the Russian strategy. The Minsk agreement was that the breakaway republics would negotiate with Kiev about having an autonomy within the Ukrainian state, and that was actually agreed at Minsk. But of course, it's never been implemented because Poroshenko was totally opposed to implementing it, and he. He basically was a warmonger. He's basically saying we're going to take these territories back, including Crimea. Zelensky, when he won the election, promised that he was going to negotiate with Russia, and that's why he won, because he said to people, we just want to be a normal country. We've got to settle this, so let's settle it.
But it isn't finished yet, because the signing off today on absorbing these territories into the Russian Federation, which has been ticked off by the local residents in a referendum, will be the first step towards the formal annexation, they say here. Russia's constitutional court will need to verify these. The decree Putin has signed complies with the law, and it needs to be ratified by Russia's houses of parliament, the State Duma and the Federation Council. So it's not a slam dunk yet, Ron.
No, it's not a slam dunk, but I would doubt that the Duma or the Russian parliament would not ratify the annexation of those four republics.
So why is this happening? We had this enormous mobilization as well last week, didn't we, just before the UN General Assembly in New York of 300,000 reservists. So this is really beefing up the Russian military effort, and now also the territory which the Russians consider their own.
Well, if you look at a possible strategy pursued by the Russian government, this could be their end game. They realize that the military campaign in the West has gone very poorly. They don't have the capacity anymore. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the weaponry. They're running out of weapons. Their supply lines have been cut off to wage any effective military campaign in the West. So the end game could be, let's get as much as we can from our war, or military operation, as they call it, in Russia, And then, possibly, we could negotiate a formal withdrawal from the rest of Ukraine, and that will allow the Putin government a face-saving settlement. And politically, that would possibly salvage his government, because I think he's under extreme pressure. He's now getting criticism from, again, within the higher ranks of the government, and I think this might be part of a strategy to limit the damage, so to speak.
Well, look, one of the reasons that the Russians seem to have gone up a gear in Ukraine, 6 months in, they've been doing a fairly softly, pushing forward maybe 1 kilometre a day, minimal civilian casualties compared to what would be happening in a normal war, is the introduction of these HIMARS missiles. They are something between 50 and 100 mile range. They are, well, they're called rockets, HIMARS. The R in it stands for rockets. I'm not sure what the whole thing stands for. But they're not rockets. They are guided missiles. And the Russians are saying, well, if you're going to bring these in, that means you can start hitting Mother Russia. You can start hitting towns and cities up close to Moscow. We're not having this.
Yeah, exactly. And that puts Russia on the defensive. And that's why Putin was talking about defending Russia, even using nuclear weapons. And that, you know, goes back to my original point about this dangerous escalation. And I think Martin hits a nail on the head, really, and he says that basically we have to be very careful, because that this brinkmanship that seems to be evolving could end very disastrously.
What about the UN, Martin? I understand the UN Security Council have been meeting to talk about this pipeline sabotage and, you know, the apparent escalation in Ukraine the bringing in of these new provinces and the referenda into Russia.
Well, I believe that the UN Security Council was convened by the Russians as a result of the pipeline blasts. What's happened in this last week in East Ukraine is not that dissimilar to what happened in Yugoslavia when I was an aid worker out there. Kosovo, there was no referendum. The West just presumed that the Kosovo Liberation Army represented majority opinion in Kosovo. And eventually we went to war with Serbia. 78-day bombing campaign. We hit the Belgrade national TV station, killed their weather girls. We actually hit the Chinese embassy. The Chinese knew that wasn't an accident, and it made them mad. And we intervened, you know, promiscuously. And I suppose when you're talking about a deal, you could end up with a situation where the Russians will say, we will recognise Kosovo if you will recognise our annexation of East Ukraine. And I don't think there's anything really that different in Ukraine than in Yugoslavia. The population in the east of the Ukraine is Russian-speaking. They don't speak Ukrainian. They've got a different alphabet. And that, you know, when Ukraine became an independent state in 91, there's always been a balancing act between the two big communities, the Ukrainian-speaking West and the Russian-speaking East. And they had to be a sort of compromise to keep the show on the road. And they got quite good at doing that compromise. But, of course, the West decided that they wanted to pull the rug under that with the coup in 2014, and which actually... You know, the shootings in the Maidan Square, which supposedly sparked the coup, were carried out. There's been a court case in Kiev in 2018 where the Berkut riot police were exonerated. They didn't shoot the demonstrators. We know who did shoot them, because people testified on video from Georgia that they were the shooters. And they've been brought in. They were Georgian mercenaries who were brought in probably by NATO intelligence services to shoot the demonstrators in order to provoke a coup. And that's the sort of thing NATO does. I mean, they've done it all over the world. The idea that NATO is a purely defensive organisation, the Russians don't believe that, and they're right.
So it's also interesting, isn't it, the timing, both of you, with the sanctions and the referenda. I mean, it just seems as if, actually, maybe the sabotage of the pipeline, if it is NATO, which it certainly looks likely it is, and these extra sanctions on Russia are all timed to coincide with these referenda.
Yes, I think so. I don't think you have to believe in conspiracies, but I think... and I don't think it's coincidence. I think Russia has taken the offensive politically, and that caught NATO and the EU off guard. And I think they responded as the only way they could, and that is basically to impose more sanctions.
Well, the problem with the sanctions is, I mean, you mentioned earlier that the US is one of the only countries that's self-sufficient in oil and gas. Yes. But, of course, the Russians are self-sufficient in oil and gas, and they're also, of course, since 2014, become self-sufficient in food. they've become a major food exporter, which wasn't the case before, certainly wasn't the case in the 70s. They had to import lots of food, and they actually sold the oil to pay for the food, and that made them vulnerable. And, of course, what they've done since then is they've paid off all their national debts. They've become self-sufficient in food because, in fact, of course, once you get their agriculture properly organised, what they've got there now is not like family farms, but they're not like the stuff that they used to have before. Grudinin, who was the head of the... He ran as a presidential candidate for the Communist Party. He's a manager of one of these big farm complexes. And these farm complexes are private sector, but they are big. You know, they employ lots of people, they use lots of machinery, and of course the farmers, all or the people who work in this industry, have pensions, secure jobs, and so on. And it's actually something that works. And it was always the case that if they got their act together on agriculture, they would be able to do that, and they've done it.
Well, I'd like to have a listen now to a piece which I put up last Friday as part of our show, and I sent out last weekend to all of you lovely subscribers out there, which was an interview with Scott Ritter. So we're going to hear the tail end of that now, where he puts together what he thinks is going on here. And it'd be interesting to see if you agree with him militarily. This is the significance of the mobilisation of all these troops, Martin. Is what Scott is saying is that the 300,000 that have been mobilised are really just going to free up, basically quadruple the Russian fighting power. They're going to free up a lot of regular soldiers that were doing security and stuff behind the lines for a potential major offensive. So that, for example, so they could take out the Kiev government. They could potentially go, he's saying, go all the way to Berlin if they needed to. Well, luckily, they don't, he said, and that NATO doesn't have anything except nukes to stop them. So you're shaking your head there, but let's have a listen to what Scott Ritter has got to say, and then we can hear from you after that.
The 200,000 plus that are currently there. When I say plus, you remember there's militias from the Donetsk People's Republic, Luhansk People's Republic. There are, in addition to the Russian forces, there's National Guard units. The Chechens are from the National Guard, the former Ministry of Interior forces. There's volunteer units. There's Wagner, the what they call a PMC, even though it's not a PMC. There's a large force of people that prizes around 80,000 or so that are beyond the 200,000 Russians that are there. But let's just talk about the Russians that are there. These are frontline combat troops. These are troops that are configured to wage offensive and defensive conflict in accordance with Russian doctrine. When they went in, I mean, I think everybody said it appears they're insufficient to the task, because one of the things that has to happen when you take territory is you have to hold. So even though we speak of 200,000 Russians, the Russians aren't able to mass 200,000 people at a point of interest and doctrinally launch an attack. They've had to keep people back in rear area security, protect lines of communication, protect power plants, protect political zones, population centers, etc. And this strips away about two-thirds of Russia's combat capability. So even though they have 200,000 people deployed, they actually only have about 60,000 that can engage in frontline combat on a 1,000-kilometer front. So that's 60 guys per kilometer. That ain't much. And so what the 300,000 is going to do is, the Russians have been clear, these are not frontline troops. They said straight up, you're not going to the front. So any notion that some dude that's been out of the military for 5 years, put on a little bit of a belly, maybe got some arthritis in the shoulder, I remember what the rifle range looked like, but hasn't fired around since then, that they're going to take him, put a uniform on him, and throw him right into the meat grinder? No. What's going to happen is they're going to fall in on pre-existing reserve units. So literally, once these reserves show up, overnight, Russia's combat capacity will nearly quadruple on the front line. Quadruple. And that is a massive game changer. This will now enable Russia to do doctrinal offensive operations. That means that when the First Guards tank army comes online, it's not going to be piecemeal. It's going to be the whole damn First Guards tank army, and they are going to do what doctrine tells them to do, which is to blast a hole into Ukrainian lines, penetrate into their rear, spread out, and annihilate everything. And they'll be supported by the 20th Combined Arms Army, the 6th Combined Arms Army, the 56th Combined Arms Army. You're going to have four Combined Arms Army online. And there ain't nothing that can stop. To be frank, if they wanted to go to Berlin, they could go to Berlin because NATO's got nothing to stop them short of nuclear weapons. Now, fortunately for NATO, they don't want to go to Berlin. But they will go as far as necessary to achieve the objectives of the special military operation, even though they may rename it. Namely, that's demilitarization. The entire Ukrainian army has to go. Whether they want to die fighting or they want to surrender, it's up to them. But they're gone. They're finished. It will no longer exist. This means that the Zelensky government's out. A new government's in. Maybe the gentleman that the Ukrainians just released, the pro-Russian Ukrainian politician that was just exchanged as part of a prisoner exchange. Maybe he'll become the new president of Ukraine. Who knows? But they're gone. And all the political infrastructure associated with the right sector, with Sloboda, with these neo-Nazi political movements, the worshippers of Stepan Bandera, they're going to be eradicated, eliminated, terminated. And Russia now has the military force to accomplish that. Look, when this war first started, I said I thought it would be over soon because I thought Russia was going to go in doctrinally. And I'll tell you right now, Ukraine could never have stood up to a Russian doctrinal offensive. NATO can't stand up to a Russian doctrinal offensive. But that didn't happen. The special military operation went in with a completely different mode of operating, and this thing is extended 6 months. Russia is now about to put doctrine on the table, slam that book down there and say, this is how we're going to fight this war. Game changer.
So that's the former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer and weapons inspector in Iraq, Ron, Scott Ritter there, saying that he thinks actually things are really going up a gear now with these 300 reservists. All those frontline troops may actually launch some sort of major offensive now, and they've now got the capability, they've got the men, they've got the weapons to, you know, in a very short period of time, actually defeat the Ukrainian army fully.
But that's a very interesting, very provocative analysis. I'm no expert in military strategy or in military operations. It's clear that, from what you're saying, that the capacity of the Russian military will be improved. But I'm not convinced that they have an adequate supply of weapons. I've been reading the New York Times, Washington Post, and they suggest that Russia is going to have to possibly import weapons from China because they're short of supply of them. And that also assumes that Russia actually still has the stomach to carry out an offensive which will result in a greater bloodbath, not only for the Russian troops, but for the Ukrainian troops and Ukrainian people.
Martin, what do you make of what you just heard? He's suggesting there that the Russians are preparing not only to potentially flatten the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian army, but also to be ready to take on NATO if necessary.
Well, when Putin made a speech the other week, Shoigu, the defence minister, is a very interesting character. He's actually Turkic origin, so his first language is Turkish. He said, we're clear now that we're actually fighting the whole of NATO. It's not just the Ukrainians, and that's why we're doing what animals do, which is to show, look, we are big enough to crush you, so don't provoke us. I don't think they are going to go and try and take over the non-Russian speaking parts of the Ukraine. There's no use, no purpose for them doing that. They've actually the area of which they control now is Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's another U.S. military figure. A retired military figure. They've got 80% of the GDP capacity of Ukraine is in the bit they've taken. West Ukraine is largely rural. There is no industry, and that's of course the war.
It used to be the industrial heartland of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, the Donbass was, but yeah, the West Ukraine is rural.
This is the bit they've been fighting over.
Yeah. And the
does that mean there's a lot of natural resources and things like that?
Yeah, there? They've got natural resources. They've also got the infrastructure,
isn't
you know, the steel industry and stuff like that.
These wars
are
so often over resources, aren't they? Anyway, look, we've got the potential here brewing up now of this enormous sort of double whammy. One, which is a military confrontation. Another one, Martin, is an economic one at the same time. And is that, will one precipitate the other? How do those two work together?
If you've got
a military fight going on and an economic, it's literally meltdown.
Yeah, but I mean, if you think about World War II, it was fought militarily, but it was also an economic battle, wasn't it? It was about production of shells and bombs and tanks and all the rest of it. I think the Russians have prepared, you know, they knew, they've done everything they can to try and avoid a direct confrontation, which is why the Minsk agreements were so important. France and Germany were guarantors of the Minsk agreement, and the Minsk agreement was actually between the Kiev government and the breakaway republics. And then, and the Russians simply, the Russian government was simply a guarantor, and wasn't even a guarantor in the same level as Germany and France. Now, they've now reached the point where they are going to. The point about annexing these republics is that they are now part of Russia, and that means constitutionally, any attack on those republics is an attack on the Russian Federation, and they can respond, as the US would respond if there was a Russian incursion from Mexico, yeah?
Or maybe into Alaska or something. Anyway, so looking at the economic side of everything that's been going on, it's been a momentous week with Kwasi Kwarteng, or Kamikwasi Kwarteng, and Liz Truss's policy being a complete disaster around the world, our wonderful new Prime Minister. So let's have a listen now to the economist Steve Keen, I spoke to earlier today from Bangkok, giving his analysis of what's going on right now.
It's basically hardcore neoclassical thinking that's behind this. And you have people who simply believe that the government should have really no role in the economy at all, hand it all over to the private sector, let the wealthy create the wealth, and it'll trickle down to the rest of us. And I say, I'm actually a great fan of trickle-down economics, because it actually is pronounced properly as trickle-down. And it does a very good job of tricking the down, because it argues to the down that if you give the money to those who are up, it'll finally come down their way. And of course, it does nothing of the sort. And one of the easiest ways to understand that is, even though people like Bill Gates and whoever owns the major British companies are incredibly wealthy, have lots of money, but they spend it very slowly because they don't. They spend what they've got so slowly that if they would cut off income completely, it might take them 10 years to run their bank accounts down to zero. Now, you and me and the people poorer than us, they basically, any money they get, they have to spend straight away. So you spend money much more rapidly if you're poor than if you're rich. And if you want to get a big stimulus out of putting money into the economy, you don't give it to the rich, you give it to the poor. They'll spend more quickly. So this is actually wrong in every possible way. And it just seems that we've got the worst possible people running the economy at the most crucial time.
What do you make of the failure of any kind of forecast to be produced? And they're now saying it's going to be the end of November before the Office for Budget Responsibility publishes its analysis of how this is going to affect the economy. Now, that's quite a long time when we're looking at quite volatile markets out there and all sorts of other things going on, such as the war, sabotage of pipelines, this sort of thing that can also affect those markets.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't particularly care about the Office of Budget Responsibility. I think this is the Office of Budget Confusion, because the whole attitude is that the government has to borrow from the private sector when it spends. And when you do the accounting properly, as I do, I've actually built a software package called Minsky to enable this to be done. When you look at the government, it doesn't borrow money, it creates money. And when you have the government trying to run a smaller deficit, it actually is creating less money. Now, of course, what's happening with Truss and her chancellor is they're going to create a large budget deficit, but that money is going to go to the super wealthy who don't spend it. So it's a poor way of doing the right thing. There should be a large government deficit now. It should be providing money to the people at the bottom end of the social scale so that they can pay for their drastically increased energy costs. They're getting some of that, but not a lot. And you should be trying to make the UK economy resilient against climate change, which means large-scale investments in renewable technology and in local energy production, rather than having to import from overseas. None of that is being done.
Yeah, well, this is Kwarteng and Truss's argument. They're saying, well, by making sure that the super rich can retain more of their wealth, that they will invest in these necessary projects that we desperately need.
Well, they'll invest in them overseas if they invest in them at all. And what they're more likely to do right now, and this is actually going to happen out of higher oil and gas prices, is the money's going to the very companies you want to shut down. So there's no way the market has got this right. And this is the absurdity. The market has got an incredibly short-term perspective. Once you get that around your head, you realize that the market thinks in terms of quarterly reports and things like that. It's the last institution that's capable of doing long-term planning. When you want long-term planning, you need government, you need experts getting involved and saying what we need. And that's not what's being done here. It's all coming down to quarterly reports. They'll pump money into oil, gas and coal, and then the whole thing will become impossible to maintain because of the impact on the global climate. And we'll have the wrong infrastructure at a crucial time.
Well, there's quite an important moral side to this as well here in the UK, because people are being told that the benefits, even though we've got inflation creeping up and up and up now into double figures and up from there, we are saying that, well, benefits are just going to be staying at the same level. So if you can't feed your kids, tough.
Yeah, and this is going to lead to social breakdown. This is the problem. Austerity never worked. And the UK has really suffered from about a dozen years of austerity under the Tories and to some extent under Labour beforehand. And what austerity does is it means you try not to create cash. That's what's actually happening. The government should be creating money. That money should be being used for education, health, et cetera, and also for new investments in long-lived infrastructure. And by not doing it, you've now got a less capable economy at a time when you simply have to become more self-sufficient with the breakdown of globalization.
Well, you were saying earlier about that's actually reducing the role of government. This is part of the ideology behind this. If the government isn't running things, who is?
Nobody, or rather the coal companies are. And again, you get the short-term perspective of Wall Street. It's all about rising stock market values. It's not about building the latest technology. You can get some inspired entrepreneurs who do have a long-term vision and use their money in that sense. But the vast majority are trying to build a successful share portfolio, and they'll jump under the latest fad rather than looking at what the long-term needs of humanity are.
Now, you know, obviously a lot of this is to do with the enormous great hike in energy prices. I wonder if you could explain two things, really. One, what you think's really behind that, and secondly, what they should have done, because what she's done is she's taken I think the figures are around about $130 billion to give to these energy companies as a form of price subsidy.
Yeah, I mean, we should never have privatized the energy industry. The whole idea that private provision works in long-term, long-lived assets like that is simply wrong. And what they've done is they've built a market based on the concepts of conventional economics. And conventional economics says that the more you produce of anything, the higher the per unit costs are. So they see rising costs coming from what they call diminishing marginal productivity, to use the jargon. But they basically say it gets more expensive if you produce a high level of output. Now, when you do the empirical research, you find that, in fact, that's absolutely wrong. The higher the volume of output you produce, the lower the per unit costs are. Firms are built, thankfully, by engineers rather than economists. They get more efficient as they approach full capacity utilization. So they've got a wrong model completely. But with that wrong model, what they've said is the highest cost producer sets the prices for everybody else, in a belief that's the highest, what they call marginal cost. So you're getting enormous prices being generated by this artificial market that's been created in energy. And that's then giving a huge revenues to all sorts of companies, some of them being renewable companies, but a lot of them being fossil fuel companies. The last people you want to give your money to right now are fossil fuel companies. We should be shutting them down, not financing them. But that's what's happening with this huge boost, both by the higher price and also by the subsidy that Truss is giving directly to the companies.
So that's Steve Keen there speaking to me earlier today. I think that's brilliant hearing him break down the way that the energy market actually operates and why it's such a disaster. It seems like we're paying for our energy the highest possible price. It's almost like levelling up or leveling down. I mean, how would you call it? What you're doing is you're just paying as much as the energy market can manage to squeeze out of you, and it's all completely artificial. It's nothing to do with the actual cost it takes to get this energy out of the ground. So I'll put the link to the full version of that interview, maybe about twice as long or so, up on our show page tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Before we say goodbye to Ron, I'd just like to play this clip from Liz Truss. She's done this wonderful thing where she goes around all these local radio stations this week, speaking to the BBC local radio, and just before the Conservative Party conference. And this is what she has had to say to BBC Radio Bristol. She's blaming everything on Vladimir Putin, on these hiking energy prices. So let's see what our guests have to say about that.
I mean, it's hard to know what has fallen more since you entered Downing Street, the value of the pound or the Tory poll rating. But on a serious note, no one can deny you entered Downing Street with a difficult job on your hands, but you've made the situation worse so far, haven't you?
Well, let's remember the situation we were facing when I entered Downing Street was that people were facing bills of up to £6,000 this winter for their energy. We were facing very high inflation and an economic slowdown. And I and the Chancellor have taken decisive action to deal with that. From this weekend, the energy bill price guarantee comes in, so people will be facing no more than £2,500 for a typical energy bill. We've also taken action to reduce our tax burden and spur.
Yeah, but Prime Minister, with respect, that is the same scripted answer you've given to every BBC local radio station this morning. You've got the Bank of England stepping in now to try and clean up a mess a government has caused. That has never happened.
We have a very, very difficult economic global situation because of the war that Vladimir Putin has perpetrated in Ukraine. And countries are under pressure around the world.
Yeah, but this isn't Putin. This isn't just about Putin. I mean, your Chancellor on Friday opened up the stable door and spooked the horses so much you can almost see the economy being dragged behind them.
This is about Putin and the war in Ukraine. That is why we are.
So the Bank of England's intervention yesterday was the fault of Vladimir Putin, was it?
What I was saying is it's very difficult and stormy times in the international markets. And of course, the Bank of England is independent. It takes the action it needs to take. And it is responsible for interest rates and it is responsible for financial stability. But it is right that the government took action to deal with people's fuel bills. It's right that we took action to deal with the excessively high tax burden, and it's right that we've taken action to get the economy going. And the vast majority of the package on Friday was about energy support. And if we hadn't acted decisively and quickly on energy support, people would be facing these appalling fuel bills this winter. I think that's what's important to note. Of course, it's a difficult situation. Of course, the decisions are tough, but we have to do it.
So that's Liz Truss speaking to BBC Radio Bristol. There is actually, I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight, almost an hour of the various interviews around the country on different BBC local radios. And the BBC Radio Bristol did very well. Actually, the questions they asked her were very awkward. And you know what? I think it's ever so difficult to tell exactly. I suppose I should sit and measure it with a ruler. But the long pauses after the questions were very telling. And we heard a couple there, didn't we? So Liz Truss is just thinking, oh my God, how do I answer that? And she's probably been taught, look, if you don't know what to say, take a long, long, deep. But anyway, she certainly wasn't able. And also there's a bit of a lack of emotion in her voice there and no sort of understanding of the way that millions and millions and tens of millions of people are being affected by her reckless misuse of the economy. Anyway, Ron, what do you make of that? She's blaming it all on Russia.
I'll just say it in one sentence. Her policies have just thrown more oil, no pun intended, on the fire. And even the IMF has come out critical of the policies pursued by the Truss government. They're arguing that basically those policies remind them of regimes in the global south, you know, and making miserable for the general population.
Yeah, that's almost like she is turning Britain into a third world country or a developing country, Martin. So that's what she's trying to do. I think, you know, just mixing that slightly with what I was asking Steve Keen about, saying, well, in a way, what's happening here is the only part of the taxation of the super rich, which the British taxpayer can actually get their hands on, is their income. So that's the only bit that can be taxed. As they get paid, they then get that the tax comes out of the super rich's income. What they're now saying is even that, because of course once they get that money it then goes offshore and you can't get your hands on it, so they're saying even that little bit that we used to tax of the super rich, we're no longer going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the ideological basis of it is drivel. I mean, I used to teach economics at A level in the 80s, and it's all based on the idea of the so-called Laffer curve, Arthur Laffer. And it's just a normal distribution curve drawn on a graph. And on the basis of that, he said, if you've got any tax, what happens is, if you've got too high taxes on the wealthy, the actual tax take for the government goes down. Now, I think there is something like a Laffer curve. I mean, but we used to have in the 1950s, the top rate of tax in the US was 96% and in Britain was 95%. That's why we could afford to fight the Korean War, build an interstate highway system, a national health service, because you had a tax base to do that. And of course, the wealthy never liked that. But in actual fact, it was quite an efficient thing to do. If you think about it, most bosses and capitalists are trying to force down the wages of their workers, and the rest of society, it's in our interest for the wealthy to get whatever services they're providing to us at the cheapest price. So it means that you tax them.
In a nutshell, the announcements that have been made by this new government have both been disastrous. So one is to stop any taxing of the super rich and make sure that benefit claimants pay for it by not having their benefits brought up in line with inflation, which, oh dear, by the way, is starting to creep up. But then there's also this decision on fracking. Now, even the boss of Quadrilla has said that this is not a good idea. And a close second to Radio Bristol was BBC Radio Lancashire. Now, they've got a lot of experience of fracking up there. And so it was interesting to hear what questions that the Radio Lancashire journalists put to Liz Truss. This is delightful to hear because they really know their stuff up there, and she doesn't seem to know anything about the subject whatsoever.
Scott Benton, the Conservative MP for Blackpool South, in a tweet says he believes that people in Blackpool South do not support fracking. This is the Tory MP for Fylde, Mark Menzies, in the House of Commons.
If the Prime Minister is to remain a woman of her word, a woman that we can believe in, which I believe she is, can the Secretary of State outline how that local consent will be given and demonstrated in my constituency of Fylde?
What does local consent look like, Prime Minister?
Well, the Energy Secretary will be laying out in more detail exactly what that looks like, but it does mean making sure there is local support for going ahead. And
it,
I can
it,
assure
it sounds
you,
like you don't
and I can
know.
Assure, and I can assure Mark Menzies. Well, there are various detailed issues to be worked through, but I can assure Mark Menzies that I will make sure there is local consent if we are to go ahead in any particular area with fracking.
But your local MPs don't want it, all Conservative. In the past, the County Council have said they didn't want it, yet your government overturned it. The science hasn't changed. Why can't you tell us this morning there won't be a return to fracking in Lancashire?
Well, I don't accept the premise of your question.
Why?
It's certainly the case at present. Because what I've said is if there is local consent, we will go ahead. We need to explore where there is local consent and where there isn't, and we're still doing that work.
Your Chancellor,
I don't think we should rule out the whole of Lancashire.
You talked about how it's a success in other countries, but in America, they do it in the middle of nowhere. Do you actually know where Preston New Road is, where they have been fracking?
Well, I don't think I've been to that site in the past.
Shouldn't you?
Well, as I've said, we will only go ahead with projects where there is local consent. I'm very, very clear about that. Now, we will make sure that local consent is in place. And if there is a concern about a particular site, those concerns will, of course, be looked at and taken into account.
Let's talk about people's pockets. What do you think the people who voted Tory for the first time and elected a Tory MP in places like Burnley, in Hindburn and Blackpool South, will they still be thinking that you're on their side? You've given a big, huge tax cut to the highest earners. They'll get about, on average, about 10 grand a year back. Will your Red Wall supporters think that that's fair? Is it fair, Prime Minister?
Well, what is fair is that people were facing huge energy bills this winter of up to £6,000. And because the government has stepped in, we are making sure that nobody faces energy bills of a typical, more than a typical £2,500 from this weekend.
Yeah, well, a close second anyway. I think BBC Radio Lancashire did quite a good job there in hauling her over the coals. Ron, this whole business of fracking, it worked in America apparently, but it doesn't look as if, and we've got a whole mobilisation going on around the country right now of campaigners who want to save their water supplies and stop the earthquakes.
Well, my response to that, she kept repeating the mantra, we'll be sure to gain consent. I don't know what she means, be sure. Are they going to stack the deck? Are they going to bribe?
I think that's it, isn't it? They're going
to bribe the district councils or the county councils to go along with it.
They can give people compensation.
I don't know what they mean about this. We'll be sure to have local consent. Already, those communities have expressed their clear, outright disapproval of any fracking, and most economists have, and most environmentalists have, for very good reasons.
You wanted to say something about what's happening with the National Health Service as well, didn't you? Because we've got...
we could have a whole show on that.
Oh, no.
My God.
But anyway, it's in a bit of a crisis again. I mean, it does seem as if right since Andrew Lansley, in the 2010-2011 Cameron government, there has been an attempt to really, I mean, first of all, to privatise, but also to just make the whole thing unworkable so that people have to go private. They've got to go and get private health insurance. It's a US model, isn't it?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, we don't have time to go into much detail, but the waiting list for elective treatments like hernias, knee, and hip replacements, tonsillectomies, hysterectomies, could be well over a year in some localities. It's the waiting list is 6.7 million. It's going to go up to possibly 10 million. We basically have an ambulance handover crisis as well as ambulance or paramedics as they pick up a patient. They cannot get that patient to A&E because there are not enough beds. Reason why there are not enough beds because 10,000 beds have been cut since 2010. But even then, you have elderly patients who cannot be discharged because they have a social care crisis. There's not enough nursing homes or residential homes. So it's a very vicious cycle. So you have a lack of resources, a lack of spending. And then Truss is talking about cutting £10 million from the NHS budget to tackle bureaucracy at a time when actually they need £20 billion to deal with the crisis. But I think you hit the nail on the head. As more and more people, middle-class people, who may have savings, who could afford £10,000 for a hip replacement to go private, to vote. But people, you got a single mother raising three children living in Southmead, they don't have the means to pay for a hernia operation or any elective treatment.
Well, we're in an extraordinary situation where we've got something like 1 in 10 British people, in fact, it may even be more than that now, waiting for a very simple, basic operation.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my major concern, and I'm going to close on this note, the audience probably can tell I'm from the United States, and I've had a terrible experience with private health care, and I'm not going to go into any detail, but I think a sizable proportion of the electorate is being conditioned to accept private health care. And I think if the Tories are re-elected in the next general election, they will say, we can't afford the NHS. It's too much demand. We cannot meet that demand. So we'll have to have a private health care insurance system. And that will be that'll be the end of the NHS as we know it.
Well, I think there isn't going to be another Tory government. Certainly, if you look at the polls at the moment, I was listening to a pollster earlier today saying in his lifetime, he's never known the polls shifting so much. We're now at between 30 and 35% lead for Labour, which is a 30% increase in Labour over Tory in just 1 week.
Well, that might be a good reason why we should have a Labour government rather than a Conservative government. That's not a not plug for the Labour government, but it'll be less pain for the general population if we have a Labour government, because at least the NHS will receive the priority it deserves.
Do you think maybe the city, the establishment, has decided that the Tories are going to go out next time and Labour, let's get them in? Because it does seem to me that, that it's the donors of these parties, the people with the money in the City of London that make the big decisions.
Well, I think they've lost trust with the Conservative government, but the Conservative government basically seems to be in the pockets of the Adam Smith Institute and the IEA and the Free Market Forum, basically pushing ideologically driven policy, and Truss thinks she's Thatcher and Mark too, and I don't think that's washing with the not only with the general population but many of the powerful interests in the country.
Anyway, I know you've got to go, but you are now sitting down next to Ruth Nesta, who's joined us, both from Acorn. Do you want to just say a little bit about Acorn, why you joined them? What are they?
Well, I joined ACORN because they have a very good reputation as a community union fighting for the interests of communities, waging campaigns around public toilets. They're fighting for the interests of renters who are getting a very bad deal in Bristol. But I joined because of the abysmal bus service within Bristol, and knowing that in Manchester, the bus service has been brought back into public ownership, and I hope Bristol ACORN will back a campaign to do the same here.
Okay, Ron Mandel, thank you very much for joining us. Have you got a blog or anything like that you'd like to plug before you disappear?
No, I don't have a blog, no.
Oh, well, I think you should. I think you should, because you've got all sorts to say.
That's not a bad idea.
Okay, anyway.
Nice meeting you.
Okay, now we're joined also from Acorn by Ruth Nesta. Hi, Ruth.
Hi.
Lovely to see you. And you're here really to talk about your own housing situation, aren't you? Because you had a bit of a difficult situation with Bristol City Council, of all people. Weirdly, you actually owned your own home too. So can you just take us through when this happened and what happened?
Yeah, most certainly I'd like to do so. Bristol City Council actually raised a debt against myself, and that debt was shrilled up. Initially, they claimed I owed them $16,000. When they took me to court, it increased to the cost in the case to $45,000.
So is this a council tax?
Yeah, council tax liability. And part of that council tax liability was what I was rightfully entitled to because I'm long-term sick and disabled.
And so they were saying that you hadn't claimed your council tax rebate or whatever, and that's so you had to pay that £16,000. So where are you supposed to get that £16,000? Were they expecting that you sell your house and pay it that way?
Well, most certainly what from their attitude, they showed that I should, that they would increase indiscriminately, they would increase and shrill up these debts, and they didn't even care that I was long-term sick and disabled.
Okay, so when are we talking about?
We're talking about all of these really started in the year from 2002. When they were actually bringing all of these debts.
Right, okay. So are you actually claiming benefits as well then?
I was, yes.
I had a bit of a bad experience with Bristol City Council too. This is about seven years ago, something like that. After I started getting a decent income, came off of benefits and started to pay council tax, I had a direct debit, and they started taking off far more than they were entitled to off the direct debit. Now, I lost something like, say, I think it was about £800-900, like that, which they refused to pay back because they'd been taking more than they were entitled to from the direct debit. So it's almost as if you're dealing with a bunch of sharks dealing with Bristol City Council. How is it that, and this, of course, is since pretty much since the end of the old system where we had a council leader. We're going to be going to back to that, and I think is it now 3 years time, and over to the mayor system. It was very much more a kind of corporate top-down kind of council. So when this all came to a head and it came to court, can you just take us through what it was like for you?
Well, it was very traumatizing for me in that I was not well. I was on a drug called pregabalin. It had my brain like what I would describe as like scrambled eggs, I would say. I didn't understand pretty much what was going on.
So it was difficult for you to think straight?
It was.
I mean, I don't know, if you can't think straight, it's not easy to fight a court case, is it?
No, it isn't. And it allowed them to take advantage of my vulnerability, given that I was on large doses of opioids and the pregabalin combined together. Two different opioids, I should say. One was codeine and one was tramadol, in addition to... So what a cocktail mix was that. And they capitalized on that vulnerability, only focusing on stripping me of the asset that I own.
What, your house?
My home.
So are you still in the house?
I'm still in that home.
Well, thank God for that.
Thank God for Acorn.
So anyway, so what happened?
Well, there was a huge, they actually took me to court and took out a possession order for something that they don't own. And they had this possession order and they were going to come sending in bailiffs to put me out of my home. And Acorn came along, had less than 24 hours from a member defense resistance against them, because they'd already come on the 25th of October, having the bailiffs axe open a hole in my bedroom door in the presence of the children and trashing all our positions all around.
How did they get into the house?
They drill out the locks, front and back door, whilst I was down in two Redcliffe Street Court.
While you were in court?
While I was in the court, they drilled out the locks.
So they knew you were out of the house?
Yes. Well, I saw a vehicle outside of the house when I was leaving on the way to go into the court. And my partner said, "That looks like them." I said, "No, it can't be them." But it turned out it was the bailiffs who were outside the house before I could even get to the court that morning.
Good God, that's incredible. So what happened inside the house?
Well, they trashed the possessions, created a load of hazards. It being just before Christmas, it was...
So which year was this, sorry?
This was 2021.
Right, last Christmas.
Last Christmas, just gone.
A little bit less than a year ago.
Yes, yes. So Acorn came, they had a huge member defense, nearly 150, I would say, persons around the house in order to protect me and my children and my family from these vultures.
But they were already in the home.
They were in, they drilled and they came in, changed the locks. But when I came back from the court, I noticed that they sat in a vehicle. They knew what they were doing was wrong.
How do you know that?
Because once I entered the home, they were not coming in as brazen as when I was not there.
Martin, this sounds a little bit sneaky, doesn't it? The idea that you wait till someone goes along to the court case and then you break into their home.
Yeah, I did. I used to work for Bristol Debt Advice Centre, and one of the things I was researching was council tax bailiff behaviour. And, of course, the fundamental thing is that council tax is an unfair tax. But there used to be the rates, which were based on the value of properties. Council tax is on individual people. And it's very difficult to collect because lots of people, the whole idea of council tax is that poor people would pay it and therefore they'd think twice about voting for services and so on. And it's never been, you know, we had 13 years of Labour government and they didn't repeal the council tax. And but the bailiffs, it's council tax is what's called a preferred debt. Yeah. So you have to pay it. Whereas, of course, if you got into debt with other private companies, you can negotiate bankruptcy.
There's something quite frightening about all of this, though, because council tax is imposed on people that don't have any money. And, of course, if you don't have any money, how can you pay it?
Well, this week, I've had to ring up the department because they sent me another bill of £4,000. And then I rang them up and I said, this nonsense that you're going on with, it has to stop because you're preying on vulnerable people. You know that I'm not working. You know that I have a disability, but you don't apply my entitlement to that rebate that I'm entitled to. But you send me a liability that you think. So he said to me, shall I set up a repayment plan? I said, certainly not. I said, you certainly get it right.
So what's their argument for why they are not giving you your council tax rebate? I mean, this is quite worrying, isn't it? Because we've got, there is a system whereby our wonderful mayor, Marvin Rees, will say, well, we're giving everybody a rebate if they're on benefits. But obviously, they're in a situation, and maybe Martin, you can talk to this. They're in a situation where people with absolutely nothing are expected to pay bills of £2,000-£3,000 from nowhere.
Well, I think you are entitled to a rebate if you are a disabled person.
Well, just a minute, because this is a gift from the council. They are giving I think it's called council tax relief. If the council wasn't giving this council tax relief, everybody, including the sick, elderly, disabled, even minors, if they were in a house on their own, they would have to pay it. Otherwise, they're going to get the house taken off of them.
Well, the council tax is a very inefficient tax because the rate system...
What I'm saying is a tax on people that don't have any money.
Yes, and that's why it's inefficient, because you can't get money out of people who haven't got any money.
No, but you can get any possessions that they've got, can't you, and sell them off and make some money.
Yeah, I know, but...
It sounds to me like it's a horrific form of bullying.
Well, I don't know what's your particular case, obviously,
yeah.
But it may be what they're saying to you is you didn't claim it, and therefore you're not entitled to it because you didn't claim it.
No, that's not it at all, because if you think of the situation... that it is continually that they continue to do this to vulnerable adults, because they took me to court for £10,000.
Yeah.
I went to every solicitor in Bristol to help me to fight that case. They said that it sounds complicated, but it wasn't that complicated. I decided that I've had enough. Enough is enough. And I stood in that court against Robin Denford, who stood there and told a pack of lies because they had already received council tax for the property. But they wanted it a second time over. And they wanted it a third time over because not only they made my home that I was living with my family, they made it a home in multiple occupation. So three times over, they want the same council tax. Isn't that fraud? So I stood against them. In the court, the judge dismissed it, threw the case out, and they then told them to remove the charging order that they had placed on the property. That charging order, they then removed 2,000 out of the 10,000. 8,000 then they placed on the property. And it was only after the resistance by Acorn that I consistently started researching on the internet to find a lot more information how to get them remove this charging order. And I went on. I went on and I found laws on the land law. And I found out about the Fraud Act Section 1. And I made representation under the Fraud Act Section 1 with Bristol City Council. There was a ridiculous woman called Caroline Saunders who is responsible for all these actions, what she's doing, using charging orders to actually deprive people of what is their natural rights.
I mean, it just sounds to me like greedy, wicked people just going for the vulnerable, because maybe they're finding it more difficult to get tax out of the rich because the rich can have solicitors and stuff to defend them. I mean, surely, partly, Martin, this is to do with the cutbacks in legal aid, because in the old days it would have been simple for Ruth to go down to the Avon Bristol Law Centre, which, by the way, seems to have completely vanished. The phone number doesn't work anymore. And simply get a solicitor to defend her in court for free.
Yeah, I had a solicitor that was supposed to defend me to get that 8,000 charging order removed. She was from Southwest Law. She did nothing to remove it. In fact, I found that she was actually assisting them to defraud me. And that £8,000, it was only January 2022 when I got them to remove that off of the property. And despite me paying them $22,000 out of the $16,000, they still feel to themselves that they could continue to harass me and to put me out of the home that I own. And I will continue to fight for the home that I own. And I've said to the police, and the bank actually backs me, right? In their ridiculous ordeal that they're putting me through, the bank will not support them in harassing me, but they continue to harass me and think that they can actually take my home away from me.
Well, look, Ruth, for some people, they wouldn't be able to cope with what you've had to go through.
What I went through, my doctor told me, I'm a survivor. I am a survivor because what I have gone through, many people would have tripped over. Some people would have even taken their own lives. But for me, at one point, you could not get me to talk about this topic. Ever since there was the Acorn resistance, they continue to give me from strength to strength, side by side, the defense that they've put up to support me against this ridiculous council that we have. And I believe they're the worst council in this country.
Well, you're not the only person to say that. I can remember going to an awards ceremony in London, well, it must be 15 years ago, and they say, oh, you're not from Bristol, are you? Oh, God, you poor people. They are pretty damn appalling. Anyway, you're not the only person in Bristol who's angry with the city council because there was a fire last weekend in Stapleton Road in one of the council's blocks of flats where a electric bike which was being charged in the hallway caught fire and apparently the alarm systems, I mean it's difficult to know exactly what happened, didn't operate correctly, and one person had to try and get out of a window and sadly died as a result. I think he was an Afghanistan national, actually.
That's right.
which is even worse, because it's, you know, there are people who can't necessarily, they come here, they're given a place, asylum seekers or whatever they are, and suddenly they're caught in a situation where there are problems with the council housing. And anyway, I mean, I don't think people should be charging their bikes in hallways, because obviously they do sometimes catch fire. They're not safe. These, whether it's a car, a bus, or a bicycle, you're charging, they aren't safe, and they should be charged outside. Really, there's a lot of talk about how great these new electric this, that, and everything else is, but you know they are dangerous. So anyway, the mayor Marvin Rees was away. He's not in Bristol. I don't know where he is. He wouldn't say where he was.
But I want to touch on a point about the fire that you mentioned before we go on to the mayor. About 10 to 15 years ago, there was another fire in that said building. And it was on the second floor, just as you go into the building on the right-hand side, that very first flat. The man was toasted in there. He was burnt. He couldn't get out. Now, with Bristol City Council knowing that they own that building, all they did was redecorate that flat and rented it out again. It meant that the safety conditions of Twinnell House had not really been risk analyzed. And now there's a second loss of life.
So you know what we've had? We've had the Grenfell fire in London, haven't we? And there's lots and lots of pronouncements by local authorities, government, particularly here in Bristol. They've said, oh, everything is safe now. Of course, it's not, is it?
safety should come first. Safety should be first, of paramount interest, not for them to relinquish their responsibilities. Bristol City Council needs to focus on the safety. Many people are complaining and they're not responding to the complaints that they've come. I've certainly sent in 4 complaints now, and Bristol City Council have not responded.
No, that's right. Their complaint system, you may as well not bother with it. Go straight to the local government ombudsman, I'd say, because the Bristol City Council complaint system doesn't exist. I had to complain about one of their officers who threatened me. And when I filmed it because he was a parking enforcement guy who parked on a double yellow line. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I started to film him. And then he came towards me, threatening me. And I thought, oh, well, I'll film this too. But complained to him about him to the city council, saying it's perfectly legal for me to film. Your employees are not allowed to threaten me with physical violence. And you know what? They had a look at it. It took them about 6 months and they said, oh, there's nothing to see here. It's fine. If our employees want to go around threatening the public, that's fine. So that's their complaints procedure. I have to agree with you, Ruth.
Yeah.
You know, complete waste of time. And I think the people in, is it Twinell House?
Twinell House. Well, I complained to them about my disability facilities grant that is verified, and they refused to hand over my disability facilities grant to Bristol We Care and Repair so that I can have a level access shower, a raised toilet, and an adaptable kitchen. In my kitchen, it's dilapidated, it's crumbled down because of Bristol City Council's negligence. Sarah Hooper refused to hand over my disabilities grant, and she should be named and shamed because she is a qualified OT.
A what?
Qualified occupational therapist. Right. And the head manager at Bristol Accessible Homes, and she should be ashamed of herself.
Well, I hope she is. After she's been named and shamed.
Named and shamed, Sarah Hooper. You should be called out and shamed.
Well, you just have been. Anyway.
I wrote to her professional regulatory counsel to report to her appalling conduct that she won't hand over my disability facility grant.
No, well, the council, Martin, will say, oh, we just don't have enough money for this. It's all central government's fault.
Well, that may be true, but it doesn't excuse the council's mismanagement of its own mission.
Well, and also refusal to hand over a grant, which Ruth has obtained a grant, but the council won't hand it over. Anyway, we're going to hear now from BBC Points West last night, because after this fire we were talking about last Sunday, 5 days it took Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees to turn up on the scene, because he was out of the city. He wouldn't say where he was. We don't know if he was out of the country. Maybe he's on one of his jetting trips over to Vancouver or whatever to do his climate talks, which he doesn't like people criticising him for doing these long air flights to around different parts of the world to talk about how climate change is so important and yet causing it and creating it himself. So let's have a listen now to the report, because Tristan Cork from the Bristol Post caught on film one of the residents from this council block of flats trying to throw water. Obviously, this is to do with, you know, this is how you put a fire out with water. But the council were apparently just not bothering to listen to the complaints. And also, it took the mayor a very long time, 5 days, as I say, to actually even bother to turn up at his own property to see what had happened to this poor dead man.
The Mayor of Bristol was confronted by angry residents today at the scene of the weekend's fatal tower block fire. People living in Twinell House demanded to know why Marvin Rees hadn't been to see them sooner after a man fell 16 floors trying to escape the blaze. Lee Madden reports.
It was a hostile reception at Twinell House for the mayor today.
It's embarrassing for him to show on, his face, like after 4 days when the incident happened. He's the man who's representing for this city. And basically he didn't have time to come in to show his respect. We lost one of our own who lives in the building. And then that's the city he's representing.
It's now 4 days since Abdul Jabbar Oriakal fell to his death while trying to escape a fire on the 16th floor. Today, 3 police officers were called to the building to help calm tensions. Once Marvin Rees was inside, residents say relations did improve.
people did calm down and listen. You know, there was no point in screaming and shouting. You didn't get anywhere, do you?
How many people were in the meeting?
Probably only about 15 or 20.
So that's not many when you think how many people live here. Why do you think most people chose not to go?
A lot of people are worried. They're worried of repercussions from the council, but also apathy. It's that, oh, we've heard it all before.
We had a very constructive conversation with residents just about the building itself, how it was supposed to work in the event of a fire, and the building did work the way it was supposed to work. The fire was contained. People were able to leave in an orderly way.
One thing that a number of residents have told us is that they are angry that it has taken you 4 days to get here. Why has it taken so long?
Well, the important thing is to make sure that all the processes are in place to keep people safe.
Why has it taken you 4 days?
Well, I wasn't in the city.
There's no sprinkler system in the flats at Twinnell House.
There's no doubt that they do reduce risk, but I think the key thing here is the measures in place for this building worked well. The compartmentation did not fail. The cladding was not involved in the fire. The alarm system functioned as we expected.
The City Council's Cabinet are due to look into investment in sprinkler systems next week. Lee Madden, BBC Points West, Bristol.
OK, so that's BBC Points West yesterday talking about this horrific fire. But, I mean, it's like the mayor appears to be living in a parallel universe. First of all, he's saying that there was no problem there, that everyone got out in the correct manner. Well, one resident didn't. He came out the window 16 floors to his death.
Very bad indeed. He certainly doesn't have an understanding what risk analysis is about. And somebody needs to, bring Marvin Rees to what risk analysis means, because he doesn't know a man has lost his life, that young man. And that man had a family, you know, he has children, and he necessarily lost his life.
Now, Marvin Rees himself has been given a kind of vote of no confidence, really. People have said, well, we don't want this mayor system anymore, Ruth.
Most certainly, I don't think that his job is bringing any positivity to this city. You know, I mean, he doesn't even want the toilets to come back, public toilets. Now people must be squatting and just piddling in corners. We're living in a time where we have more delivery drivers because people are ordering a lot of stuff from groceries to everything online. So why shouldn't those delivery drivers should be able to have access to public toilets? And Marvin Rees doesn't see it as a priority.
Martin, what's going on with the mayor? He's not actually talking in a real fashion there, is he? He's saying everything worked fine. Now, of course, it didn't work fine because someone has died, having to jump out of a 16th floor window.
Yes, and of course, it's not very good politics to turn up 4 days late.
Some of people have commented, it's actually nearer 5 days late because it happened in the early hours of the morning.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I mean, as you know, he's not going to...
And he's given no explanation as to where he was or why he didn't turn up.
Well, he's not going to be... You know, he's on the way out, isn't he? He's not going to... there isn't going to be another mayor and he's going to be the last one.
Do you know what you're suggesting is he doesn't really care?
Well, I think people... What he would say, I mean, obviously, you know, I can't speak for him, is that he won the last... He was re-elected on transfer votes last time and therefore he must have had some support in the city. But of course, you know, people are going to be, you know, whoever was running it is going to be open to criticism if they get it wrong and people don't feel they've done the right thing.
Well, there's a lot of people, you know, this is the backdrop against this, which this is set, Ruth. And we're going to hear another final one of the clips from our Prime Minister, Liz Truss, is this whole, basically a war on poor people. So the rich get the tax breaks, but the poorest in the country are finding it more and more difficult to get wages. We're seeing, you know, you and I met at this event, didn't we, where they're launching this thing called Enough is Enough.
Enough is Enough. Yeah, that's the... the rally that actually is bringing to everyone's attention the cost of living crisis, the fact that There's no financial congruence to actually meet your income and expenditure. I mean, it's not right. It's just not right. We just can't just not be spending and don't have the income to meet it.
Well, the maddest thing is that we've got inflation at the same time, so it's all going up in price. Anyway, let's have a listen to the last clip from Liz Truss now. And this is where she was grilled by some rather good journalists. And it's nice to see, because I used to be a BBC local radio journalist in London, which is a bit of a bigger station than most of them. But to hear these young BBC local radio journalists giving some awkward questions again and some longer silences here to the Prime Minister, so-called Prime Minister, who doesn't really seem to know what she's doing, although she can read a script, Liz Truss.
We're facing a very, very difficult international situation following Putin's war in Ukraine.
I understand that, but now people are worried about their mortgages and worried about when their fixed term ends, whether they'll be able to afford a new deal, and that will dwarf any of the savings that you've made doing anything else. You've done this yourself. This isn't to do with external forces. This is about your mini budget and what it's done to the economy.
Well, interest rates are a matter for the Independent Bank of England. And the fact is that in response to the global economic situation, interest rates have been rising around the world. So they've gone up in the United States. They're going up in other countries. But they are a matter for the Independent Bank of England here in Britain.
The Bank of England have had to bail out your decisions yesterday. The Bank of England have had to step in. The International Monetary Fund have said that they don't think what you've done is a good idea. Is it time to reverse what you've done, bearing in mind what you've seen over the last few days, the damages caused to the pound?
Well, no, it isn't, because the vast majority, or the majority of the package we announced on Friday, was the support on energy for individuals and businesses. And I think that was absolutely the right thing to do. I think the idea that people are facing fuel bills of £6,000, that companies would be going out of business, it would have been unconscionable to allow that to happen. And also putting up taxes during a recession or, you know, during an economic slowdown would have been a grave mistake. It was the right thing to do. Of course, you know, we face difficult times and the world is facing difficult times. But this government has acted decisively to deal with those issues that people face.
How will easing the tax burden for people earning hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds help people in Stoke-on-Trent who are wondering whether to have a meal, a hot meal in a night, or to put the heating on?
Well, first of all, we've taken decisive action to help people with their energy bills, and that is the majority of this package. And we are reducing taxes and not increasing taxes across the board. We had a 70-year high in terms of the amount of tax that the government was taking from people and from businesses. And my concern was that that was stopping economic growth. And ultimately, what economic growth is about more investment in places like Stoke. It is about getting the companies investing, getting those new jobs, getting those wages.
That's what people ultimately care about.
So that's Liz Truss speaking to Radio Stoke. But she's, again, I keep getting the idea, Ruth, that this government is in a parallel universe. How long do you think it's going to last?
I don't think that it will last very far, a long time, simply because, let's take, for example, rent. There are many young people today, they cannot actually afford a rent. There isn't a living rent. And that's the reason why Acorn wanted a living rent commission to be set up so that people can actually afford the rent. And because the rent is escalating in the high cost, it's pushing up hyperinflation and causing many to actually not be able to afford their basic essentials.
Martin, how long do you think Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng will last? Because it seems some of their fiercest critics have been from within their own party, their own MPs.
Well, I mean, it's been a pretty spectacular
It's only a week since they made this announcement.
I mean, the one thing that hasn't been mentioned that people really need to get their heads around is that the Bank of England intervened to buy up government debt because the pension funds, of which most people who have private pensions have got their money in pension funds, were about to go bust on Wednesday afternoon. And so the bank had to intervene to prevent that. Now, that if that is to do with the recklessly ideological approach to these things that that they've taken. In actual fact, as Steve Keen pointed out earlier, you should probably be borrowing money or creating money at this moment. There's no reason to squeeze the economy. But you can't at the same time say to the wealthiest people in the country, well, we're going to cut you, why don't you go and have a party? It just doesn't make sense politically or economically. And of course, if the British economy starts, what's now happening is that speculators are seeing the gap between what the Bank of England's doing and what the government's trying to do. And that means that they're not confident that that there's actually a coherent policy. And therefore they sell the pound, which forces the interest rates up, which is then going to crash the economy. And of course, Germany and the US are worried about that, because if the British economy implodes, it will then have impacts on other countries. Yeah.
It already is having impacts, isn't it? What about Steve Keen's point about the difference between borrowing money and creating money? Because the Bank of England can create money, but the government...
Yes, but they don't. You see, Steve Keen is an unorthodox economist, and I agree with him that in actual fact, the government shouldn't borrow money from the private banks. It should create the money and then give it to the population. And of course, the private banks have intervened into this situation. They've interposed themselves into this. So we had a situation where during the austerity years of Osborne, they are borrowing money from the banks to bail out those same banks. And of course, that's bonkers. And of course, in China, for example, they don't do that. The banking system is ultimately run by the government. And that's why they can just cancel debts if they want to. But we can't, because we've insisted that there's got to be a private sector profit in everything. And
we've reached
the end of this kind of
Martin,
cycle.
These private banks have got quite an interest in getting the British government into as much debt as possible, because he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Well, that's right. And the reason why we've got a big national debt is because of the bailout of the private banking system.
So it started in 2008.
Yeah.
We've had a couple more since, haven't we?
Yeah, but then they say, well, look, we've got, you know, Rachel Reeves, who's the shadow chancellor, was saying because of the money spent during the pandemic and everything, we can't afford to do any of the radical things that we promised we might.
Oh, dear.
And that's because we've always got to balance the books with the private banks. Now, what should have happened in 2008 is we should have said, we're finished with private banking. Once the Royal Bank of Scotland became a government ward, you just say, right, well, it's going to remain a government ward. You know, we are going to run the system.
With the trillion-pound bailout, it was nearly £1 trillion anyway, in 2008, Gordon Brown, your lovely Labour Prime Minister, said, I've saved the world. Well, actually, he sent the world into a death spiral.
Well, what he did was, if they hadn't done that, the banking system would have collapsed. That is true. But of course, the point is, once you've done that, you've got to say, right, it's the private banks that are the problem here. We've got to get rid of private banking.
When they collapse, don't they just go?
What would happen, because they're so big and they've interposed themselves into the situation, if they collapse, a proper free market analysis would say, let them go down. If they've made wrong bets and they're losing money, just let them collapse. The problem is that when that happens, they pull down everything else with them, which is why you've got to intervene, which is why it shouldn't be run by the private sector in the first place. Mm. And, of course, in China, the banking system is ultimately run by the government.
Russia is actually similar, isn't it? Places like Iran as well. They have very strong national central banks. They do have private banks too, but they're told what to do. Almost like, you know, this is the Kremlin here. As a private bank, you can do your thing, but don't tell us what to do. Over here, we seem to have invited the HSBC.
That's because the banking oligarchy has been the main power in our country for hundreds of years. The City of London is very, very powerful.
What I would want to say on this note, I would say with a very prudent banking system that we have, I find it very difficult that nobody is actually even remembering about the gold reserve. What's happening to the gold reserve? And what's backing up?
So this is what is actually behind this currency. Are these just little bits of paper?
Yes.
Well, I mean, what's now being talked about, Sergei Glazyev in Russia, who's a top economist there, is working with the Chinese to develop an alternative to the US dollar, which will be based partly on gold, but also on other commodities like oil and gas and so on. And what they're trying to do, because the dollar is basically a scam that allows the US to steal from the rest of the world.
Right.
Yeah. They run huge deficits, and everybody's got to pay for stuff in dollars. So everybody's got to have dollars, and that means that they can do what, you know, it gives them loads of room for manoeuvre. But of course, the Chinese and the Russians are now trying to close that down.
So they
have
this power.
They got
this power after the Second World War, but they have abused that power.
Well, they've abused it all along, but of course they've now reached the point where, you know, bigger boys are now saying, you know, we've had enough of being told what to do by you, and we're not Bangladesh, you know.
Okay. Well, look, on a similar topic, I mean, we had Mark Carney was our Bank of England governor. I don't know if you remember him, Martin.
I do.
Well, he was also on the policy committee of the Bank for International Settlements. We heard about them last week from Catherine Austin Fitz, who was doing a conference in Holland, explaining how the Bank for International Settlements, which is the central banker's central bank, is planning these central bank digital currencies. So the idea is that if the ordinary currencies that we're used to now start to fall apart, then actually we can go over to this lovely new digital money, which they control. But Mark Carney is the director of a company which owns a company called Centre Parcs. And Centre Parcs are planning, unbelievably, to build near the M23 motorway in Surrey, on the Sussex border there. Actually, I think it's more Sussex, isn't it, than Surrey. A place called Old House Warren, which is a beautiful old area of ancient woodland. And I joined Dave Bangs and the Landscapes of Freedom campaign last Saturday down there for a lovely, well, it ended up being nearly a 5-hour walk. It was quite a walk all around this beautiful area in a mass trespass where we had 250 trespassers all turned up. We had a fantastic time.
Wow. I'm just going to say I'm really just a few words, and then we'll move off. Before I even say those few words, I just have to say that Caroline Lucas, the MP for the Green MP for Pavilion, is putting the rights around the bill to Parliament in the next session, next month or whatever it is. Marilyn Shirley is my hero. She's the Doyen of the land rights movement and the movement to save the countryside from capitalist ecocide over the last 50 years. She wrote three fantastic books, which I'm going to pass. And the first one is called The Theft of the Countryside, 1981. Read it. The second book is called This Land is Our Land. Read that as well, although it'll take you longer. And the third book was called The Right to Roam, and it was written specifically to resource the campaign for Michael Mitre's Bill Right Minister of the Environment, his Crow Bill in 1998. Read those three books.
Old House Warren is facing destruction for a giant centre park development. It'll rip the heart out of Worth Forest. Yet most of Worth Forest, 70 to 75%, and most of Old House Warren, about 60%, is forbidden to the public. Yet if we do not know the forest, and we do not know its beauty and its wildlife, we will not know how to fight and defend it. We cannot champion its rare, beautiful, important, weird wildlife and landscape if we are not permitted to know it, to fall in love with it, or to feel we own it. We cannot fight for nature if we do not know it. What the eye doesn't see, the heart will not grieve. And that's why we're here. Because if we don't spend our time in this place and know it and love it, we'll be unable to fight for it in a meaningful way.
So that's Landscapes of Freedoms. Dave Bangs from Brighton leading the procession, I suppose it was. I took some lovely photos. I'll stick some of them up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk of this great long line of trespassers all snaking their way through these beautiful woods where the fact that they've excluded people over the last 20 or 30 years from most of this woodland, there is a bit where you can walk, is one of the reasons why there is an awareness campaign going on to just tell Ruth, local people, that the woods are there. Because there's, I think, you know, that we are in many ways excluded from the land where we were born.
That's right. I'm most certainly coming out of Guyana, which we have intact all our natural rainforests and green spaces and things like that. I do like the tranquility of natural green spaces, and I do believe that people have the right to explore those natural green spaces where they can walk. And in fact, it's very good for your mental health and health as well. Health is wealth. So,
Martin, yeah, I sort of slightly unfairly was saying to you last week, oh, you don't really care that much about things like this. But you do, don't you? And you do understand. So what's the significance of the idea that, you know, we've now got this situation where quite a lot of people who are wealthy, rich people like Mark Carney, his friends, not only do they want to develop these beautiful little bits of land, but they also, quite a lot of them, are just simply seen as money in the bank. This place where we were walking last Saturday, there's been no management of the land there whatsoever. And a lot of it is really in a pretty awful state because it's not been managed. You know, for example, you've got trees which have fallen and just been left there for 10 years or something. You've got also areas of footpaths which are in a real mess because no one is allowed to walk around there. So the point being is that this land does have to be managed, but for many people they just see it as money in the bank nowadays. It's not actually a resource that anyone should use, and if they let somebody on there, then they think, well, actually we don't really want to let anybody on here because it's worth more if we've got exclusive access to it and none of the public are allowed here.
Well, I mean, the landowning classes in this country are very powerful. They always were. And if you actually look at who owns the land in Britain, a very large chunk of it is owned by the people who came over with William the Conqueror in 1066, and they've still got it. And that is the country we live in. We haven't had a revolution like there was in France,
so
where
sure.
The landowners were dispossessed.
I'm not sure the old aristocracy is as big as it used to be. I think what we've got now is we've got banks taking over
They work hand in glove. The Duke of Westminster no doubt has very good banker friends, but he still owns the centre of London, and he makes an awful lot of money.
I've recorded it, but we did have somebody who was talking at the end of the rally saying, well, I think you're a bit unfair on landowners, because where we are, and it's true, in Gloucestershire, for example, a lot of the big landowners in Gloucestershire do allow open public access to their land. Some of these aristocrats do that, but the people that don't do it are the, I suppose, what you call the bourgeoisie, these new not free market types, but I mean, you're talking about the merchant classes you've taken over, people who just see land as an investment rather than a living landscape.
Well, I think there's a phrase that was used about Britain, gentlemanly capitalism, and the merchant classes traditionally used to marry their daughters off to the aristocracy, and the aristocracy used to marry their sons off to merchant daughters and so on, and so that they melded together as a block. And of course, the commercial, seeing land as a commercial prospect, was very much part of the commercial revolution in this country in the 17th century, 18th century, and the precursor to the Industrial Revolution. Now, all of these historical facts don't go away. They continue to influence generation after generation after generation because it's established power structure.
Anyway, I was quite interested in the nuanced thing where people are saying, well, actually, we don't really have too much of a problem with many of the aristocratic landowners because they allow access. Anyway, Ruth, what do you make of this? I suppose here in Bristol, you know, in these urban centres, It's becoming more and more difficult to find somewhere to go, actually, which is countrified. And we kind of need it, don't we? I remember when I was working full time, literally, in a very, very frazzled. This is back in the noughties. When it came to a Friday afternoon, I felt like I've just got to get out of the city. I want to get a bit of, you know, countryside
for
to breathe.
Weekend.
Yeah.
We used to go to Forrester Dean, cycling and things like that. We used to arrange trips for the children to be able to go to these open spaces. And for my children, I still send them because there's a camp that actually takes the children out of the inner city, St. Paul's area. And I think it's very important that these activities are maintained for children who actually are growing up.
Yeah, it's not necessarily good for kids to just be growing. I think many parents, when they first have children, are looking to have some nice environment to bring those kids up in, which is
a little bit
more rural rather than a city environment, because you're kind of boxed in, aren't you, in the city?
You have to be able to appreciate these green spaces rather than to be remained in a matchbox, as I say. It feels like a matchbox, and most certainly exploring the green spaces could actually, is better for our health, is better for us to be able to explore the environment in such a way that they, and I certainly feel even the prisoners, they should be drafted in. As you said, there were trees falling for so many years, the environment was unkept. Why not bring them out into the communities and allow them to, whilst they're exploring, do some cleaning up?
Not such a bad idea at all. But, I mean, one of the main landowners, of course, is the monarchy, and the top of the aristocracy is it's King Charles now, isn't it? The Queen has disappeared.
The third.
What did you make of the whole death of the Queen and all the ceremonies? Did you follow that, Ruth, or do you think it's one of those things which is really not relevant these days?
Well, I believe it is very relevant because in terms of the colonialism and the taking of the wealth from all these countries and people not knowing the history behind all of that, it's just a grim reminder. The Queen having passed away is a grim reminder, and it's brought it to the fore.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because she was presided over a time where those bits of the empire were relinquished. She was someone who was saying, well, actually, we don't really need this anymore. Let's just return these people, these lands to their original people, the end of the British Empire, really.
Well, they're still in the Commonwealth, for example. They are part of the Commonwealth. But what is the Commonwealth there for? You know, what are the benefits the people are gaining? And those are the things that are not explored and examined in the wider.
Okay. So yesterday we had quite an extraordinary, publication of the Queen's death certificate. And I was quite shocked to see the time of the Queen's death was announced as 3:10 on the death certificate. And yet, as many people will know, there was people tweeting that the BBC had announced her death on the day, which is the 8th of September, actually at 2 p.m. So the BBC turned their website black at 2, and yet we're told she died at 3. What do you think, Ruth?
I can give you some insight on that, having worked with health service and knowing a background from the coroner. And it could be explained that if someone dies and the time, let's say, for example, that person died at 6 a.m. this morning, if the doctor doesn't arrive until 10 p.m. tonight, then the time of death will be 10 p.m.
Oh, okay. So it may be that the Queen died and it was announced to some people, but the doctor took a while to arrive, and that's why she was pronounced dead at 3 p.m.
She could have died the same day that she met Liz Truss, but at the time the doctor arrives is the time of the death. And that's the complication of...
Well, okay, so we've got one problem, and that is the time of death. So
yes.
There's lots of problems with this death certificate. In a way, you know, lots of journalists have been asking for it to be released, and because there was no cause of death announced, particularly, that's why. And now, it was when it's published yesterday, it's raised more questions than it's actually solved. And I spoke yesterday to Dr. David Halpin about this, because he's had a look at the name of the doctor who's on the death certificate, and he's not actually registered as a doctor in the United Kingdom. He's not a medical practitioner. Maybe he's a doctor. Of astrophysics or something else, but he's not a medical doctor. And also, the cause of death is not allowed. What they put on the death certificate is that the Queen died of old age. That is not allowed to be entered on a death certificate as a cause of death. So let's have a listen to what Dr. David Halpin has got to say about these various, well, three specific anomalies on the death certificate.
There's a website about filling in death certificates, MCCDs as they're called. This is the Scottish NHS website. And I quote, when writing a joint cause of death, state the interval of the first condition identified. First condition, they're very specific about how it should be laid out. It's all very sensible. In causation, intervals must be provided for all items, with the exception of, inverted commas, old age, which may be allowed in certain circumstances, most commonly in an unexplained gradual decline leading to death in a patient over 80. Well, in her case, there was not a gradual decline, as you know. So, in fact, if I wrote old age on the Queen's death certificate, any proper registrar, this is in fact the registrar general who's in fact signed this, top dog, it would have been rejected. And I told you there's a young doctor I once wrote old age, and I was given a rap on the wrist, had to rewrite it.
Okay, so
and I've expanded the extract. Go on, I expanded the extract of the death certificate in the Mirror. The doctor's name appears to be, as I've just told you, the GMC register. I couldn't find it there with Alan spelt with one L. I put in two L's. It still didn't come up. Okay. Glass is sometimes an Ashkenazim origin name. He's not registered on the General Medical Council. I've searched the General Medical Register, which is usually rather efficient at bringing up. I put his full name in. I don't have his registration number. But I put in his name on their search engine on the General Medical Council, and it does. They say no results. I first put in Alan with a single L, and then I corrected that and put in Douglas James Alan double L Glass in the second, and it didn't come up.
So that's Dr. David Halpin. His verdict is this guy is not a medical doctor, Martin.
Well, it's interesting to hear that, obviously, but something could be going on here, or it may be that there's not much to see here. We'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
What about what he was saying about the cause of death being old age? He said in exceptional circumstances, if it's been a very, very slow gradual decline, but we know it wasn't a very slow gradual decline because the Queen was up and about walking around, chatting and smiling to Liz Truss 2 days previously.
Well, I think people obviously going to ask questions about this, but if you're saying there's some kind of foul play involved, you've got to come up with a motive.
Well, that's you that said that, not me.
No, well, I'm just saying that the logic of what's being said is that there must be some foul play involved. Now, if there's going to be foul play,
well, maybe
you've got
a bunch of blunderers. I find it very surprising that the Queen would be surrounded by a bunch of blunderers. But look, you've got another aspect to all of this. If you take a step back from what's happened to the poor old Queen, is that you've got quite obviously she's being treated for something. You had the marks, and I'll put the full interview with David Halpin up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight. She's got a mark on her hand. David is suggesting either it was someone taking a blood sample, and if you do that in a slightly cack-handed fashion, the blood can actually run down inside the arm and make this kind of stain. He's also suggesting it could have been a cannula, which is a kind of, I mean, you know a little
the
bit about this medical
term. They'll call it like a hematoma,
right,
which is where the blood all settle around the veins and the capillaries there.
But anyway, what David is saying is, well, she was definitely being treated for something. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had these, needles in her arms or the cannula in her arm. So she's being treated for something. And if she's being treated for something, why isn't it on the death certificate? Why have they just put old age on the death certificate? Anyway, any final thoughts on this? As someone that's worked in these areas yourself?
Well, I don't think that in terms of a death certificate, old age could be applied as a causation of death. But most certainly, we have the systems of our body, and those systems are integrated. And if there's a failure of one of those systems, it does have a trigger knock on, almost like a domino effect, to actually create the decline and hence the demise. But there must be a cause that will cause the heart to stop, or for the kidneys to malfunction, or for the blood sugar levels to think. So there's a cause, something to explain the cause.
Yeah, and if there is no explanation, if someone is thinking, oh, well, it's just old age, because we don't know what, let's just put old age, even though we're not allowed to, then surely there needs to be some sort of, if there's no explanation, then some sort of an autopsy. Anyway, so three big mysteries thrown up by the Queen's death certificate. Ruth, Nestor, thanks ever so much for joining us. Been fascinating to hear your story and your insight,
thank you very much,
coincidentally, Tom. Into the demise of our dear departed monarch.
Yeah.
Mozart's Requiem there, and also interesting, I think, little snippet was in the Mail on Sunday last weekend, which was the headline was "Frazzled Herald Forgot to Shout God Save the King." Well, frazzled with a great big inverted commas around it, reading out the proclamations in the final stages of the Queen's committal was a career-defining moment for the Garter King of Arms. Yet all did not go as smoothly as hoped. The most senior herald, David Vines White, that is David Vines White, forgot to say the crucial words, "God save the King," at the end of the ceremony at St George's Chapel in Windsor last week. And in an unfortunate twist, the words were written out on the order of service, which was distributed throughout the chapel and published online. So it's all there for him to read and for everyone to see. Thankfully, though, King Charles, always keen on details, did not make a fuss. So even though God's not saving him, he doesn't seem to mind. A source in the royal household said, right at the end, he was meant to shout, "God save the King." And all those in the congregation would have done it too. It's not particularly hard to read from a script. They're very annoyed at him. But historian Hugo Vickers leapt to his defence, saying, "I imagine the poor man was frazzled. It's a bit like the poor king with his pen. Cut him a bit of slack, I think." Well, I think it was deliberate.
There's a million reasons why I don't believe it. There's a million reasons why it can't be true. Open fire, can't melt steel. It's not hot enough. It's nothing new, it's not a mystery. Check out the Reichstag, Germany. There's a million questions still.
Bye.
So that's Martin Noakes there. And just for you, well, for me too, because I enjoy his music so much. In a couple of weeks' time, we're going to have a longer interview with Martin. And his 9/11 Building 7 song was also used as a soundtrack of a film. That film was called Sierra Nevada, released in 2017, and he got taken over to Cannes to be part of the premiere watching that film, and it won all sorts of awards there. But I think it's just an amazing song, particularly capturing some of the horrifying con that was the official story to do with the September the 11th attacks. And he's been making music ever since. He's been doing stuff about COVID lockdowns and things like that, and working, collaborating with other musicians. So that's for a few weeks' time. In the meantime, Martin, what do you make of that whole sort of 9/11 Building 7? We can't just play that without talking a bit about it. It's going to be the end of September soon, but this time every year we're sort of thinking about the effect that this terrorist attack, by whom, whether it's the Israelis or the neocons or whatever, on New York and Washington, had on the world. We were hoping for a new century, the millennium in 2000, then 2001. The evil so-and-sos tried to define their new 21st century with a attack like that, which was a complete con, and it started this thing called the War on Terror, which effectively means the Americans can go into any country they want if they think there's some kind of terrorist there and invade it.
Well, yes, it's obviously of great significance even 20 years later, but of course the real significance is that I'm quite sure both the Russian and Chinese leadership are well aware of what happened there. And in actual fact, there's a Chinese government minister in the foreign ministry who tweeted recently, you know, basically suggesting that the US was itself responsible for 9/11. Now, in the past, the Chinese would have been very cautious about saying things like that because they don't want to antagonize the Americans. But I think the gloves are coming off in international affairs, and you know, the historians will ultimately, if we survive all of this, will write it all up, and it'll be pretty clear what was behind all of this. I mean, in many ways, the motives are transparent. They've basically used the war propaganda that they planned from these horrific attacks. And of course, Building 7 was the third skyscraper to collapse into its own footprint in history, all on that one afternoon. And anybody can look it up, just put WTC7 into your search engine and you will see the building coming down. It isn't even on fire, it just comes straight down, crash. It's clearly at a control, it's clearly bombed effectively,
yeah, into a controlled demolition like they do to skyscrapers. Yes, all right. Over the world. So that's some right. People are quite practiced.
Skyscrapers do not burn down. None of them have ever burned down because they've got a steel reinforced frame.
I don't know if you remember, on this show, we had an interview with Scott Forbes. I remember very well, with lovely Fran, who's sadly no longer with us, recording the interview in the park just next to Embankment Station in London, Charing Cross, with Scott Forbes, who was working with for Fiduciary Trust. And he explained that he was working in the World Trade Center the weekend before the attacks, and he noticed all these guys going in and out. Now, there'd been a power down, so there was no electricity on in the building, although his own business, he went and had their own generator in there. And his specific job was to go and bring down all of the servers for their company safely, and then to start them all up again on the Monday morning. But there were people going in and out the whole time whilst he was there, and all the security doors, etc., at the basement, the ground floor of the World Trade Center were open, and these guys were going in and out, in and out, and they could potentially have been putting explosives in the buildings.
Yes, and of course the buildings themselves were privatized 6 weeks before the attack, and therefore a whole new set of security procedures were enforced. And William Rodriguez, who was the janitor in the World Trade Center, who obviously we came to speak in Bristol some years ago, and he was clear that, you know, all of these people we didn't know who they were suddenly coming into the building dressed in overalls. So, you know, what actually happened, I imagine, is well known by global intelligence.
Will the world's public ever be told exactly what happened?
Well, I think
it might even be the Chinese and the Russians have got these documentaries ready to roll.
Well, I think that's what will happen. As the gloves come off in the conflict between Russia-China-Iran axis and the West, they are going to use all the knowledge they have about things like this in order to undermine Western governments.
A lot of the...
And deservedly so, because they did do it.
A lot of fingers have pointed at the Israelis, is that fair?
Well, I think there's a very good article on Under Review about this by a French guy whose name I've forgotten, it begins with L. And he makes a very good case that there were two false flag plans on 9/11. There was one run by the Pentagon, which was actually the attack on the Pentagon, which was supposedly, going to lead to an invasion.
Is it Lawrence Guillenot?
That's the one, yeah. It's quite detailed.
Well,
he's been accused
of being anti-Semitic, hasn't
he? Well, anybody who says anything about the Israelis is accused of being anti-Semitic. But what he points out is that there's quite a lot of evidence for Israeli involvement. Loads of Israelis were arrested. Because of the three dancing Israelis who were filming the first attack,
surprise attack.
They were questioned, and of course they eventually released and went back to Israel, where they went on television in Israel and said, "Yes, we were Mossad agents, but we weren't doing anything wrong. We were just documenting a surprise attack."
This argument falls down is the Mossad could know about it. They don't under any obligation to tell the Americans that this attack might.
I think the fact that they knew in advance that this was going to happen makes them suspects. Of course it does. In any other criminal investigation, people who know in advance that something's going to happen are prime suspects, aren't they?
You mean like Benjamin Netanyahu on the morning of the 7/7 London attacks, not leaving his office to go to the embassy or to, I think
he was
going
to go to a meeting at Liverpool.
Street. Yeah, he was told by his embassy, don't go anywhere because there's going to be it looks as if there's going to be a terrorist attack this morning.
Right.
The only thing is, they didn't tell Scotland Yard or anybody else about it.
No, but it's that is kind of, in a way, kind of making excuses. Foreknowledge implies that you may indeed be a suspect for doing it, not just not telling people.
Yeah, because 7/7 and 9/11 were supposed to have been surprise attacks, but the Israelis knew about both beforehand,
yes,
apparently.
Indeed, and the most straightforward Occam's razor explanation of that is that they were involved, just as when the Defence Intelligence Agency of the United States told the Israeli Defence Forces in November 2019 that a pandemic was about to come out of China, that implied that they knew what was going to happen, which also implies foreknowledge, which therefore suggests at the minimum complicity. And, any police investigation of that would have to start with the presumption that they were probably involved. And that's the way things ought to go. But, of course, there's a huge bamboozling effort that goes on. And it's the reason why it goes on is because it is successful. A large number of people may have some questions about what happened, but the idea that this was actually carried out by their own governments in order to start wars is too frightening. And people just put it on one side and just say, I can't go there. And that therefore, this kind of propagandistics, that the purpose of it is to get people to do what you want them to do. It's not just done for the hell of it. And it works. That's why they keep on doing it.
Well, it doesn't necessarily work. If you've got someone like Julian Assange around, oh dear, he's been locked up, hasn't he? I mean, I found it incredible talking about the supposed human rights abuses of Russia, locking people up, etc. And then, of course, you think, well, what about Julian Assange? And he's actually done nothing wrong whatsoever. How dare they accuse the Chinese and the Russians of locking people up when Assange is still rotting in a dungeon? I mean, this is something medieval about what they're doing to Julian.
Yes, I mean, that is clearly, to pour encourager les autres, so any of the journalists who are thinking of doing the kind of things that he was doing will know what the consequences might be. But the other thing I'd also mention is they assassinate people. They've killed loads of people. The CIA is, don't forget that the Guantanamo Bay facility, which we were discussing the other week, that's just the tip of the iceberg. They've got a huge secret prison system all over the world with loads God knows how many people are in it. There's no legal oversight of that. People are tortured. They're also turned into terrorists. And what they were saying at Guantanamo, they were saying Penny Lane and Strawberry Fields, because Strawberry Fields are forever. Those people stay. Penny Lane is where you send them out to carry on being terrorists.
Yeah, basically, if you think that you can turn them into someone who's useful, you can then send them out to be a terrorist that you then control.
Yes, well, I mean, there's been a horrific attack in Afghanistan on university students, and that's going to be claimed, I'm sure, by ISIS-K, which is the ISIS franchise in Afghanistan. And the Afghan government and the Russian government and the Iranian government and the Chinese government believe that ISIS is a front organisation for the Western intelligence services. Now, of course, the ordinary punters out there say, we're not on the same side as ISIS.
Martin.
But, of course, in Syria, we were.
Martin, many Afghans actually believe that the Taliban is ultimately controlled by the CIA.
Well, the Taliban...
And that some of the people who have been starting to make their way to the top of the Taliban have suddenly fallen off cliffs and had accidental accidents.
Well, the Taliban...
So that the people that are running the Taliban are the ones that the CIA want to run the Taliban.
Well, the Taliban were part of the Mujahideen coalition which drove the Russians out, and there's no doubt about it that those people were working with Western intelligence services. But the official story is that Osama bin Laden, the freedom fighter against Russian tyranny in Afghanistan, went rogue and started to do things that he wasn't supposed to. But nobody denies that he was armed, trained and directed by MI6, because he was.
ISIS and the Zionists, what you've got is these kind of Gnostic, topsy-turvy versions of all these main religions. And also, just to let you know, the evidence for the BBC website, the screenshot, which is the BBC website at 2 p.m, had turned black. That is to say, the news website is usually red, had gone black. This was noticed by an Australian journalist, and he was challenged on it. So he took a screenshot and said, "Yeah, it's 2 o'clock. You know, why has it gone black? It looks like this must be Operation London Bridge on the 8th of September. It looks like the Queen is dead." And that was 2 p.m. Ladies and gentlemen, official time of death was 3:10. And as we just heard earlier, well, you know, actually she may die, and no time of death is given until a doctor turns up. Let's just hope that it's a doctor that's registered at the General Medical Council. Anyway, talking about medicine, I'll put that screenshot up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But Martin, we're going to start off part two, although we've been chit-chatting about all sorts of things there, by looking at the, particularly at this new documentary that's just been released by Oracle Films, Safe and Effective. It's a second opinion on the COVID jabs, because initially we were told they're all safe and they're all effective. Well, it's quite clear that they're not. And here is Dr. Asim Malhotra speaking just before the launch of this new documentary, which I think was yesterday evening, actually, on GB News earlier this week.
Reanalysis of the highest quality data that we have that led to the approval of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer trials, mRNA technology, done recently, published in the peer-reviewed Vaccine Journal a few weeks ago, done by very eminent scientists, suggests a greater risk of a serious adverse event, life-changing, disability, hospitalization, than being hospitalized with COVID. That was from the original trial.
So that's Dr. Asim Malhotra, who's a heart doctor, and he's been quite outspoken about, he's now believing that the vaccines may actually be more dangerous than COVID itself. So anyway, let's have a listen now to an extract from this. It's a short extract, I think it's 5 minutes or so, of this documentary. And obviously, I'll put a link up to that, the Oracle Films documentary, Safe and Effective, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later.
For about 5 months, I did hardly anything. I couldn't function at all. I was exhausted constantly. I was in constant pain. Head and eye pain was relentless. I couldn't function. I couldn't walk very far. I couldn't read things. And I write as well as running my business. So I couldn't write anything. I had trouble processing information. So I couldn't work in my business because I couldn't follow the recipes. And I didn't have any physical strength. I got to the stage where I can function at about 30% of how I could function before the vaccine. On a good day, I can maybe do a couple of hours in the kitchen, but then after a while I have such chest pain that I have to come and lie down in here. And I used to do 12 hours on my feet working in there. It's not about money, it's about having a sense of purpose with your day, isn't it? Jobs and work is for all of us. And if you can't do those things, you do get to the point where you think, I cannot live like this. Life is no longer worth living. And we have lost people in the vaccine injured community to suicide. Yeah, you know, I didn't want to live when it was at its worst. I couldn't see the point.
These vaccines were tested thoroughly for safety and effectiveness at every stage of the development and manufacturing process. They are also continually being monitored. Now they are being used in the wider population. This means we can be confident that the vaccines are safe and highly effective.
Safe and effective? Would millions have been so confident if they'd known how different these gene therapies were? The word vaccine may have served as a reassurance, but by no traditional definition were these vaccines.
The definition in the authorities are using is not what people understand the word vaccine to mean. The public's perception of a vaccine is, you know, we're thinking about polio and about measles and the conventional vaccines, where you have a very inert part of the virus being used and it prevents the illness. These what we're using now is a different technology, it's new, and it doesn't prevent the illness.
Although it's not my traditional area of expertise, my understanding, looking at the data of the mechanism of harm from the vaccine, is that the spike protein, which we believed initially to be localized to the arm, appears to be distributed throughout the body in every major organ system for several months, causing either a direct reaction through toxicity or an autoimmune reaction. And that is the most likely explanation behind the mechanism of harm from the mRNA products.
Development of the jabs was done at warp speed, so much so that governments had to indemnify the drug companies against any future injury claims and invest billions up front. They knew they were taking risks.
As I understand it, then, from what you're saying, is that it may be that there needs to be some compromise in some of the safety measures that would normally be expected to create a vaccine because time is so crucial.
Well, of course, if you want to wait and see if a side effect shows up 2 years later, that takes 2 years.
When vaccine efficacy was declared at 95%, relieved governments gave the green light. But Dr. Malhotra argues that the methodology was flawed.
Relative risk reduction is a way of exaggerating the benefits of any intervention, clearly, which would be in the interests of people trying to sell you something, in this case, the pharmaceutical industry. So if, for example, you have 1,000 people in a trial that didn't have the vaccine versus 1,000 people that did, in the placebo group, in the dummy group, you may have 2 people dying. And in the intervention group, you may have just 1 person dying. And that's a reduction of 50%. 1/2 is a 50% relative risk reduction. But actually, you've only saved 1 life out of 1,000. So the absolute risk reduction is only 1 in 1,000. It's a big difference. The guidance has been for many years that we must always use absolute risk reduction in conversations with patients, not just relative risk reduction alone. Otherwise, it's considered unethical.
The accusation is that governments acted on Pfizer's relative risk figure of 95% efficacy, when the absolute risk was a mere 0.84%. In other words, you'd have to vaccinate 119 people to prevent just 1 from catching COVID.
Well, the point being here, Martin, that there wasn't any proper assessment done as to whether these vaccines, so-called vaccines, the mRNA jabs, were actually more dangerous than COVID itself.
Well, I think the focus on the mRNA jabs is correct. Because, of course, in other parts of the world, they haven't used this technology. In China, for example.
I mean, it's interesting how this is a form of human experimentation, and yet we just apparently just embraced it.
Well, the reason was that, you know, Pfizer are a very powerful company, and Albert Bourlau, who is the CEO, he basically took a short position on his own company and made a killing when they got the agreement that they could produce these vaccines for mass inoculation.
In fact, our friendly, should we say, well, he's a kind of resident immunologist, retired immunologist, Stanley Laham, and I just got a message from Stanley earlier today to say he's okay, because he's obviously he's in Florida. They've just been hit by a massive hurricane there. Yeah, they're okay. It's, apparently bits and bobs flown around their house by her, but they're fine, which is nice to hear. But he called it, and this is an extract from an interview I recorded a few weeks ago, which was, I thought, a fascinating retrospective. It's almost like a debriefing on the whole COVID episode from Stanley Laham. He says he thinks it was basically the world's first for-profit pandemic.
I think the main lesson is... we shouldn't have health for profit. It's a very simple lesson. This causes, encourages corruption, even in the scientific community. The health should not be for profit. I think that's the main lesson, and this pandemic, we knew that from before because of the way the health system, remember the movie that Moore had done called Sicko, which showed how corrupt the health system, how from the pharmaceutical companies to the big hospital companies to the insurance companies. It's a triad of... a triad of corruption because of the profit motive. As long as we have this profit motive, you're going to see unhealthy healthcare.
And maybe even more for-profit pandemics.
I wouldn't doubt it.
So that's, well, I'm putting the words into his mouth there, Martin, but it's a horrific idea, isn't it, that you could actually create a global pandemic just to make money.
It's not just to make money, though, is it? It's a geopolitical, I mean, the evidence that's coming out that the virus itself was bioengineered, probably by Eco Health Alliance, either through the Wuhan laboratory or the University of North Carolina.
So maybe the profit motive is a kind of cover for something even deeper.
Well, even if it was a profit motive, you don't just wait for a pandemic to come along and then batten onto it. You create the pandemic, you know, and then you create the solution, which is where you make your money. But of course, the Western pharmaceutical companies are embedded within a deep state, which was determined to bring the Chinese economy down. That's what it was about. And, well, of course, and of course, enslave the rest of humanity on the back of it.
Well, in fact, all of the interviews I've done with Dr. Stanley Laham, even though he's a very experienced immunologist explaining the immune system, have been taken down by YouTube, and which I find rather frustrating. And, of course, I will put them up somewhere else. I usually stick them straight onto places like Facebook, or if I'm banned, I think, until tomorrow again for a week on Facebook for posting a cartoon from Punch or one of these magazines from the Victorian era, which was a cartoon about the dangers of vaccines, even back then, saying that these things were dangerous. So they obviously decided that that is a crime on Facebook. You're not allowed to post those old cartoons because they, I mean, this is the main thing that was that's been going on for the last couple of years, 2.5 years now, pretty much, Martin, is there's been a concerted effort to stifle any discussion about potential what they call vaccine hesitancy.
Yes, and in any case, what the earlier clip you had, it was making the point that these are not traditional vaccines anyway. They are I mean, they've wanted to use mRNA technology for years, but they've been told you can't do it because it's too
this
risky.
This is gene edited.
It's too risky.
And this is something that actually the
but of course the pandemic then allows you to say, oh, well, although we're quite hesitant to use this technology now because it's an emergency, we're going to use it. But of course, it's only in Western countries and third world countries which have been bullied, that these vaccines, I mean, the Brazilians were bullied to take Pfizer vaccines when they wanted to have Sputnik vaccines much cheaper from the Russians.
Well, many people don't think we have a soul. Many people don't look at this from a spiritual point of view. But to a certain extent, the idea that we can, as human beings, be gods, that's part of this, isn't it? We can just snip away at genes and we can create something better. This is the whole transhumanist philosophy, Milton.
Well, the point is it's all done under conditions of capitalist accumulation.
Is it really the profit motive at the back of it?
Well, the profit motive underlies it all, but in order to get the profits, you've also got to think big in terms of smashing your opponents, not allowing them to develop their economies and so on and so forth.
Are the opponents the Russians, or are they small businesses here in Britain?
Well, the small,
or both.
Well, yes, it could be both, and Ron Unz argues that the pandemic was deliberately created by the US, and of course Jeffrey Sachs is hinting that it was definitely came from a US laboratory, and he's on the board of the Lancet. But it backfired, and it went all over the world. They didn't intend it to do what it did. I don't think that's right. I think what they intended to do was that China would be the epicenter of this global crisis, and their economy would be severely damaged. But they were perfectly happy for this global crisis to go everywhere else, because developing countries are now all going to go bankrupt one after another. Mm. And then, of course, that means that the big powerful banks in the West can take over their assets and all the rest of it.
Something we've hardly touched on today that is immensely important is this whole idea of the many millions here in Britain that are dependent on benefits. The British government is now saying, well, tough. Inflation is going to eat into your benefits, and they're not going to be upgraded along with inflation.
Well, that is the class war from the top, isn't it? People say, the sort of flannel you get from Liz Truss's, people who are bothered about tax cuts for the wealthy, or it's just the politics of envy. Well, it's not the politics of envy, is it? Where some people on good incomes are going to get a £10,000 handout for a nice skiing holiday or whatever it is. Meanwhile, people who are on the breadline are going to have what little they have taken away from them.
Well, it's this rentier.
Couldn't be clearer, could it?
Rentier economy. The idea is that everyone is basically enslaved or treated like animals on a farm. You know, you're stuck in a box. Maybe it's. I mean, one of the things which seems to be, well, they're about to implement it here, is the toll here in Bristol. And I've put up a website called Bristol Against the Toll, which is Michael Bond's report and my report. We both looked at this together, that the levels of nitrogen dioxide in the atmosphere here in Bristol are actually at the or below the legal limits. They're not above the legal limit, so we don't need to have a toll. We don't need to have a clean air zone, because the air is quite clean enough. Now, they had a similar thing in London. Now, this does look, doesn't it, as if they're just simply... I mean, you know, we heard from Ron today, coming in on the bus, that the traffic in Bristol city centre is appalling. But what they're going to do is they're going to try and cut it down by charging everybody, well, I think certainly with diesel cars, unless they're brand new diesel cars and lorries, an extra fee to come into the town. Now, this is the old thing that was going on centuries ago, which was stopped, seen as tyrannical, which is the old toll roads. So we're going to get one of those now here in Bristol from these rentiers.
Well, the fundamental problems we face are much bigger than that, let's face it. I mean, this is small beer in the big scheme of things. In the big scheme of things, we've had a global pandemic that was probably created deliberately by the Western deep state. We've just talked about 9/11, where several thousand people died that they could invade all these countries and kill millions of people.
We've been talking about that most of the programme, but what I'm saying is that this is also happening on a very, very local level, in that, you know, you've now got people who are basically just using and abusing our own local government here just to use it as a way to raise money.
Well, look, the arguments about clean air zones and what should happen with the taxation
of cars.
It's
not about clean air, is it? If the air is already clean enough, it's not.
All right, well, I mean, that's something that can be debated. But
I'll put a link up anyway to the report on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You can find it right now at synapsemedia.org. co.uk, and it shows quite clearly that we do not need this clean air zone, because the air is already below the legal limits for nitrogen dioxide, not above them, so we don't need it.
Well, that is an argument that can be had. But when we're dealing with deliberate pandemics and a potential for nuclear war and banking collapse, it's small beer, Tony.
Well, fair enough. So we're going to hear, staying on the subject of COVID, we're going to hear now from another one of these videos, which was immediately removed from YouTube, so you can delight in hearing the stuff that you're not allowed to hear. And this is from the author Greg Felton. He's the from Vancouver, Canada. He's the author of the book SARS-CoV-2, Contagion, Collusion, Corruption, which I'm... Oh, gosh, can't say 100% sure. 99% sure is the first book published anywhere in the world to evidence the fact that the SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19 was actually a man-made virus.
So the question is, why would these people collude in lying about the efficacy of a treatment and forcing people, even against their will, to get one of these injections, which is contrary to the Nuremberg statutes that came out of World War II, which said that no person should be coerced against his or her will to be a subject in a medical experiment, which is what really these vaccines are. They are medical experiments where people are guinea pigs. They are not told what the risks are. They are not told what's in these vaccines. They are not told why they're getting them. They are not given enough information to give informed consent. And that's the one thing that is missing throughout all of this. And yet so many people acquiesce to it. So many people got these drugs, thought they were doing the right thing, felt they had no choice. And now we have millions upon billions of people walking around with these drugs in their bodies that, for all we know, could end up killing them at some time in the distant future or even the near future. We already know that these drugs cause serious heart problems, and that footballers such as Kun Aguero, who played for Manchester City, had to retire because he got one of these injections and his heart wouldn't let him play football. Children are getting these drugs and they're having heart problems. Women are having menstrual problems because of these drugs. And yet no one ever explained to them what could happen. Very interestingly, in November of last year, a man named Stefan Ulrich, who's the director of pharmaceuticals for Bayer, got up at the World Health Forum and gave the inaugural address, in which he said, and I'm going to paraphrase, we are lucky that we came out with these injections when we did. It's also quite interesting that the idea of them being called a vaccine was a marketing ploy to convince people to get these drugs. Because had we told them the truth, that they were experimental gene therapies, we would have had a 95% refusal rate. I have that on video. It cannot be denied. And yet the internet is full of these pseudo fact checkers that are trying to say that he never said it or that his words were misconstrued. There is a massive attempt to backpedal, to walk back Ulrich's inappropriate, although candid and honest admission. So the question we need to ask ourselves is why the hell anybody gave these drugs to people? And this is where it gets a bit interesting, because we don't have any real hard and fast evidence. We have a lot of very convincing circumstantial evidence to say it was a bioweapon that was going to be used against China or the United States. We have evidence to suggest that it was designed to, literally, to kill people to lower the world's population, because there are too many people in the world. This is what is being heralded as the Great Reset, to remove the surplus population and to transfer billions upon trillions of dollars of wealth from the lower and middle classes to the highest income classes, the very people who need money the least. And this is one of the things that is a little hard for people to get their head around, and I don't blame them. How can you have an organization deliberately killing people, deliberately impoverishing the world, just so billionaires can have more money in their pockets? It's worth investigating because we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. Our elected politicians really are not competent to legislate on our behalf. They are essentially instruments of other unelected agencies, like the World Economic Forum. And these are the people that are really pushing this agenda called the Great Reset.
That's the voice of Greg Felton. The actual interview you can find, I will put it up on our show page, the full interview as well. And that's at thisweek.org.uk. He calls it controller virus, which I think is quite a nice idea. Deep state muscle flexing is the title of the video. And the interview, COVID, Ukraine and International Relations. And that is a interview, well, it's a talk and a Q&A that Greg did back in the end of August this year for Holding the Line, which is our journalist group of sceptical journalists, shall we say, looking at all the I think they've changed their name now to Journalists Not Against COVID Censorship, but Journalists against censorship. Just drop the word COVID. So, you know, that's us, folks. And you can find us at holding-the-line.com. So, Martin, what did you make of that? He's saying that, you know, he's going into this eugenics zone saying, look, perhaps this extraordinarily ineffective jab is just there to kill people. And I mean, of course, if we take a step back, and I address this in the interview with David Halpin, which I'll be putting up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later, that possibly both the Queen and Prince Philip died as a side effect of their jabs.
Well, it may be so, and I'm willing to listen to arguments about the jabs because the Western pharmaceutical companies, Pfizer and Moderna, are clearly bad actors in every possible way. But I think the evidence is now becoming clear. And of course, the Russians, Kirillov, who's the head of the Russian chemical and biological warfare troops, he's basically saying, we suspect that COVID was a deliberate attack. And that's out there. And it should be reported in the media, but it isn't. And of course, what Ron Unz is pointing out on his material on Unz Review is that, in a sense, talking about the dangers of vaccines is a diversion from the fact that the whole thing is deliberate, all of it, quite deliberate.
And isn't it interesting how economically and militarily lots of people may die in those ways?
Well, indeed,
as well?
Indeed. I mean, I would argue that they're not that bothered about whether they kill people or not. They're prepared to kill people. We know they are. But they're not doing it just out of ideological spite. It's to do with what wars have always been fought for, the power and aggrandizement of the people who are warmongering. And that, you know, human nature changes, but not that much. And this is what, you know, the days of Genghis Khan and the Roman Empire haven't disappeared. They've just metamorphosed. And we're dealing with exactly the same kind of sociopathology that we've always been dealing with. There were two world wars in the 20th century.
Well, we just heard also today, as a sort of final headline, Ukraine has applied for fast-track NATO membership. But will they be able to join before the Russian offensive gets moving? He's now signed this decree on the accession of these four new regions into Russia. Everything seems to be, the game seems to be going up, doesn't it, up a gear over there?
Yeah, I mean, the acceptance of the four oblasts into the Russian Federation is actually, it's the Duma that has to decide. Putin then carries out that decision.
Well, what about Ukraine joining NATO now? Fast
well,
track.
I mean, they effectively are in NATO insofar, you know, they're not.
They cannot join NATO.
No, in
they
theory they
join
can't.
NATO. They cannot join NATO.
No, in theory they cannot.
The one very, very simple fact that they're in the middle of a territorial dispute, and they can't join NATO in the middle of a territorial dispute.
That's what the silly NATO rule book says, but in actual
is it silly?
It is silly because in the actual practice of what's going on, British military personnel paid for by our taxes are undoubtedly working in the Ukraine very directly with the Ukrainian military behind this latest offensive, for example. Now, that means that the Russians don't have to, as far as the Russians are concerned, NATO, they're fighting NATO in Ukraine. So whether Ukraine is officially in NATO or not makes no real difference. In actual fact, the problem for NATO is that the Ukrainians can't win. And even if the whole British army turned up in the Ukraine, all that would happen is they would be eliminated as well. Because as Scott Ritter points out, NATO, in fact, is a paper tiger. It's very good at knocking third world countries around, like Libya and Iraq and Syria and so on. But when they're up against a peer military competitor like Russia, then they're useless.
I mean, what Scott was saying, that the newly reinforced Russian army of 500,000 could go to Berlin and only nuclear weapons could stop. Is that feasible?
Well, it's feasible, but they don't want to go to Berlin. There's no point, is there? What they want to do, I'm quite sure that they won't stop at these four oblasts, because the other southern areas of Ukraine where people are Russian-speaking, Odessa, for example, where the Trade Union Hall massacre took place in 2014, they will want to probably push all the way across there to Transdniestria, which is a breakaway Russian republic oblast of Moldova, and then that just seals off the rump Ukraine from the Black Sea. And also, you know, all the Russian speakers, if you look at the ethno map of Ukraine, the Russian speakers are overwhelmingly concentrated in the eastern oblasts. And they've, because of all the killing and everything that's happened, they don't want to be ruled by Kiev anymore. And I'm quite sure it's very similar in Kosovo. You know, the Kosovo Albanians do not want to be ruled by Serbia because the Serbs used to kill them. And vice, you know, this happens all over the world. And the Russians are really, they've shown incredible, you know, they've tried to find various ways to finesse this and negotiate it. And when it became clear that there was no negotiation to be had, they said, well, right, we're not negotiating. We're just taking what we think we want, you know, what the people who live here want us to do.
So they're really saying that that's it for Ukraine and no more Ukraine now.
They're saying that we are taking the bits of Ukraine where the majority population is Russian and don't want to be part of the Ukraine. But they're not going to take the Western Ukraine where the Russians are hated and where there's hostility going back to World War II and before. There's no point. There's nothing there for them anyway. There's no, all of the substantial coal deposits and industry is all in the eastern bit.
Well, we shall see, because things may transpire over the next few weeks. Anyway, Martin, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to wind up with I suppose it's a, you know, that's one, the one thing about this show is you're always going to get a little bit of something spiritual at the end. And I spoke to Dr. John Gideon Hartnett, who's a physicist, but he's also a creationist over in Australia a couple of weeks ago. And I'll begin to put these up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, the full interview. We're going to be having several extracts from this. I found it such a fascinating conversation, looking into all sorts of aspects of whether, whether there or not you believe in intelligent design. Did we just come out, crawl out of a pond or not? And here he is talking about something he calls genetic entropy, the fundamental flaws of modern research. So he's a creation science evolutionist, Dr. John Gideon Hartnett.
The idea of science is to, by a null experiment, by refuting, ruling something out. So what are they doing with their... say, vaccine study? They're looking for some statistical significance that it works. That's not how science works. Science is by a null experiment. So if you could then go and rule out all of the negatives, that's how science would work. So if you've got many potential possible mechanisms that could give a certain result and you went and ruled them all out, that's how science would work. But, of course, it's unknown. It's an unquantifiable quantity. And that's the problem with these medicines and drugs and vaccines. They don't know all the inputs. They don't know the conditions of all the people they're putting them into. So they can't rule out. You see what I'm saying? They can't by looking for null experiments and the negative results, they can't rule out all the other possibilities of what's causing the reaction or the result. I mean, that's why they do the placebo. Well, they're supposed to. They rarely do. But that's why they're meant to do a placebo in one arm of the trial, to say, to, in effect, that that placebo arm is not getting the drug, and so they're
what they call it is a control group, isn't it? They have a control group.
That's right. But the placebo effect itself is as powerful as most of the drugs. This is also another known effect. The human mind is really a very powerful agent. And so, but back to the original point, though, of what is science? Science cannot prove anything. So you see, it's already an impossibility right from the outset. And I think probably that's one of the reasons why there is a lot of fraud and a lot of fudging and a lot of leaning on the scales, because they know what they want to get as an outcome. And they definitely try to establish that. And I think there's another aspect to this as well, and that is the issue of the difference, or let's say the comparison between what we call reductionism and emergence. And up until recent times, the way scientific thinking, and including in the medical arena, has gone, they tried to reduce everything down to the smallest element to say that, for example, that some small element is causing the problem or is the cause of the effect that they're observing. But that is also flawed, because that's just an assumption that is an unprovable assumption. And in recent times, particularly in the human brain, studies of a neuron development in the human brain, they've discovered the reductionism just doesn't work, and that emergence is this property where 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2, it equals 10, where you have multiple elements, might be neurons, that give you more than the sum of the individuals. And often these emergent properties are not understood. And this now adds another whole dimension to, what we don't know, particularly in how would you say, how the mind works, how the brain works. And this is very significant. But it's also true in many other areas of science and in physics. It's quite significant. Okay, so look, we see many, I would say, look, you know, there are actually way too many to cover, but there's all the fraudulent side of it, which we don't need to go into, but that has been cropping up over the last few decades. In fact, some years ago, I was reading an article in Nature magazine, which is probably the leading science journal on Earth, and they were documenting how the amount of fraud that does occur in research journals is accelerating. It's almost off the charts. And in the fields of medical science, physiology, and these sort of drug development type sciences, fraud is really major. But having said that, what about those that is not fraudulent, where they claim the science was sound? And in the past, we pretty well all of us know about the failures of thalidomide, the morning sickness drug that was given to pregnant women back in the 50s, total failure. But there's other ones that are very, very remarkable. Doctors used to prescribe cigarettes, tobacco to patients for, like nervousness and this sort of thing. And yet that's a failure of science, because the unknowns were not ruled out. It's the same thing with these COVID vaccines. No one's done any long-term studies. Well, it's the same thing back then with smoking. And then also doctors prescribed heroin. That was common. Opium was common. The stimulants like the amphetamines as for weight loss and things like that. And then moving even further back into the 1800s, they prescribed mercury, liquid mercury, as a pretty much a cure-all. And yet, that's one of the most toxic materials on earth and would send people insane, I mean, causing all sorts of damage. And then in modern times, we've had this massive uptick in the occurrence of autism. Some people have calculated that we're on an exponential trajectory. Like going back, say, 50 years, there's almost no incidence of autism amongst the population. And then we see as the childhood vaccine schedule has been increased, and I think children now are getting up to something like 70-something shots for about 16 different vaccines, we see now autism accelerating. And one researcher I read about calculates that exponential growth to give us a 1 in 2 autism rate amongst boys by the year 2035. I mean, that is really scary stuff. I had a science teacher. He's not a science teacher anyway. He was over my house the other day, and he was talking about his history in teaching here in the high schools. He's been there 40 years, and he said in the early days they had no autistic children in the classrooms. But now at his school, they have as many special ed teachers, that's those who care for the handicapped children, as normal teachers. It's an equal number. So back 40 years ago, there was hardly any need for such teachers. And then moving on to the COVID shots, I mean, this is a massive failure. I mean, this on proportions that is almost, you know, one can't even, it's hard to make oneself even believe it's true. But we're seeing by some calculations, for example, the United States, which has their VAERS, their Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, in tens of thousands being reported as died after the vaccine shots. And yet, I think it's an MIT or a Harvard study found that may only be reporting about 1% or a few percent of the actual adverse events. And, of course, there's millions of non-death adverse events as well. So it looks like these COVID shots are causing a mass depopulation event. But really, I think the real agenda with them is not, well, maybe you might say it is mass depopulation, but it's definitely some form of surveillance, because we don't know what's in them, and different researchers are using microscopy methods and other scientific methods, particularly a team in Germany. They are discovering pretty wild stuff in them, like self-assembling circuits and things like this that maybe is part of a future surveillance state system. Now, I would say compared to a few decades ago, the failures in the medical science realm were small compared to what's been happening now in the last year and a half. I think this is off the charts.
So that was Dr. John Gideon Hartnett. I'll put the full interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Looking there at genetic entropy, I think fascinating topic. So the full version is really looking at the fundamental flaws of modern research and creation science, evolution and scientism. I think fascinating stuff. So we're going to have a couple more extracts in future weeks, but I'll put the full version of that for those who are enthusiastic to listen to it up on our show page at this week. www.thequeensdeathcertificate.org.uk. Major revelations this week is on the Queen's death certificate. I'll also put a copy of that up on our show page, as well as the evidence that the BBC website had gone black at 2 p.m. an hour and a bit before the Queen's official time of death. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to our guests, Ron Mandel and Ruth Nestor, we had earlier on in the programme. Do please send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. Also, please do share around these apps and let other people know that they're there, because it's all free. But you can, if you want to, donate, and you can subscribe to a weekly email list that usually goes out Saturday night or Sunday night, which has got links to all the stories. So if anything you want to follow up, it'll be in there, hopefully. That is thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Goslings. My paperback's about deals between the Allies and the Nazis during the war. That is the Bilderbergers and the Battle of Arnhem. That's the Traitors of Arnhem, it's called. Costs £15. Also, my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination. It's a pretty unique little book, that, I think, which has got extracts from all sorts of people over hundreds of years looking at secret government. That's £20. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream. Oh yeah, and links to the books, as usual, they're on one of the tabs at thisweek.org.uk. And also thanks to Camberley's Radio QUK.com, who will be streaming this programme over Sunday lunch as well, and at some other times during the week, I believe. So we've been streaming live tonight from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, and, as I said, at radioqUK.com based in Camberley, Surrey. Also, live on these Not the BCFM Politics Show apps, available free from all good app stores, including the Apple Store, not necessarily Google. Grab it while you can. Censorship and military disinformation, sadly the norm in Britain today, thanks to the collaborators who own many of the transmitters and printing presses. But I think it's a good idea to just track down in the evenings during the week Mark Stain on GB News, who's doing a fantastic job, I think. And if you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us at 5 o'clock next Friday. At talkradio.org.uk is the stream for Not the BCFM Politics Show. God bless, and don't let Basel's Illuminati banksters get you down. Yeah.
clad feather feet pounding the dust. On October's day, towards evening, sweat in boss veins, standing proud to the plow. Salt on a deep chest, seasoning. Last of the line at an honest day's toil, turning the deep sod under. Flint at the fed log, chasing the bone. Flies at the nostrils, plunder. The suffered, the Clydesdale, the Percheron vine, with a shine on his feathers floating. Hauling soft timber into the dust, to bed on a warm straw coating. Petty horses mow the land underneath, and they hide the bad eyes, slipping and sliding free. And now you're down to the view, and there's no work to do. The tractor's out his way. Let me find you a filly for your proud stallion seed, to keep the old line going. And we'll stand you abreast at the back of the woods, behind the young trees growing, to hide you from eyes that mock at your girth, your 18 hands at the shoulder. And one day when the oil barons have all dripped dry, and the nights are seen to draw colder, they'll beg for your strength, your gentle power, your noble grace and your bearing. And you'll strain once again to the sound of the guns in the wake of the deep loud chimney. Heavy horses mow the land underneath, behind the bound lightning, slipping and sliding free. And now you're down to the view, and there's no work to do. The track is known. Battle harness chained to the world, against the low sun racing. Bring the old wheel of oaken woods, a rain of polished leather, a heavy horse and a tumbling sky. dust. An October's day towards evening. Sweat in Boss Main, standing proud to the plow. Song on a deep chest sees me. Bring me a wheel of oak and wood, a ring of polished leather, a heavy horse and a tumbling sky, brewing heavy weather. Heavy horses move the land to me. Behind the plow time, slipping and sliding free. And now you're down to the view and there's no work to do. The tractor's home. There's no work to do. The tractor's on its way. All heavy horses move the land under me. Behind the plow line, slipping and sliding free. And now you're down to the pew, and there's no work to do. The tractor's on its way.